Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Brian Noonan in for Rokon and Anna DeVlantes. Happy Labor Day. Hope you are having a wonderful, wonderful holiday. We are here. The whole crew is here, the holiday crew, ready to bring you 4 hours of wonderful, wonderful programming. Hopefully you'll get involved. It's always easy to do. The number, 312-981-7200. That is the phone and the text. No, not the fax. That's what I said before, but I told you I hadn't officially started yet, so I was able to say whatever I wanted. Now I'm on the clock. It's phone and text, 312-981-7200. When you call in, you'll be talking to the very capable Joey Gelman. We've worked together before. He knows how this works. Do you know how it works? If you're nice to him, you get to me. That's the way it's always been. That's the way it always will be. Take care of the producer. They take care of you. If you like staying in touch via social media, Facebook and Twitter, it's Brian Noonan Show. So do that. We are going to talk to Ted Giannoulis. Who's Ted Giannoulis? You may know him better as the San Diego Chicken. Yes. That almost sounded like Super Chicken, the old cartoon. Was that you, Sam?
No.
No, it was not.
There's actually a chicken in here right
now. Oh, really?
Yes.
Sure. Are you going to butcher him up for later? We're going to have a little cookout?
I'm not going there. You never know who's listening.
Well, how do people think chickens get to their plate?
I just don't want them to visualize me doing it.
Well, listen, I don't think it's sanitary up there in the sports office. I've seen what you guys do up there. But if you want to, you know, start preparing food, you know, you eat it first and then we'll see how it goes. We'll talk to Ted. A 40-year career entertaining people and a historic career. He's the guy who started the whole trend of mascots at big games and professional sports. We'll talk to him. We'll also check in with Chicago Public Schools because tomorrow... The kids know this. The parents really know this. Tomorrow is the first day of classes. And some good news coming out of the Chicago Public Schools this morning, so we'll get to that as well. Talk to Mark Sapelsa at 6. A young girl was shamed at her Mississippi school, so we're starting big. This is exciting. The school year only a couple weeks old, and we already have dress code violations and dress code problems, and we'll get your thoughts on all of that as well. So, but let's start with a little Labor Day information, because a lot of people just think, oh, man, it's a day we don't have to labor. A lot of people have to work today, which I think is always nice. I love coming in here on the holidays, because what else am I going to do? Stay home and get in trouble. But I like coming in here because it reminds me of being here on the weekends when there's nobody in the building except for the essential people. And that includes the people upstairs in news, traffic, sports, Joey and I, and that's pretty much it, in engineering. Those are the essential people. Everybody else, you know, station's still running without them. We love them. We're glad they're here. But we can do it. So I like coming in on a weekday when nobody else is around. It's fun. So anyway, back in the 1800s, this is when Labor Day all began percolating here in the United States. The state of labor was grim in the United States. I like to paint a picture, Joey. That's what I do. Also, I'm quoting from a USA Today article. But the state of labor was grim. Workers were toiling under bleak conditions. We've all seen pictures. We've all read books. 12 or more hour work days, hazardous work environments, meager pay, children working in factories as young as 5. I don't know if that was such a bad idea. Kids need to earn their keep. What are they going to do, lounge around the house? Wine?
Start them young.
Yep, get to work, kids. Earn your keep. That's how Sam started. He started doing sports when he was 3 years old. And look at him now, filling in on a Labor Day with me. So all of these conditions fueled labor unions. Workers wanted to organize. In September of 1882, 10,000 workers took unpaid time off to march in a parade from City Hall to Union Square in New York City. And, of course, we know that one of the biggest turning points in the labor movement happened right down the road here in Pullman. May 11th, 1894, a strike. An engineer and industrialist, George Pullman, founded this town, you know, or built the town around his factory where he made sleeping cars, railroad cars. So the Pullman district's still there. People still live in Pullman. It's a national park site. down there. So 4,000 workers decide to go on strike because wages got cut. They staged a strike that pitted American Railway Union versus the Pullman Company and the federal government. The strike and boycott against trains triggered a nationwide transportation nightmare for freight and passenger traffic. At its peak, the strike involved about 250,000 workers in more than 25 states. Riots broke out. President Cleveland called in the troops to break up the strikers. And after that, Congress decided that they were going to change things around. They passed an act on June 28, 1894, making the first Monday in September Labor Day. And it is, of course, now a legal holiday. It is also the unofficial end of summer. Thankfully, it got warm again, so outside the Allstate Showcase studio, it still feels like summer with everybody wandering by. Especially today, it's very busy out there, which is nice. So, I don't know. We work very hard. And people here say we work probably harder than anyone in the world. Do you believe that's the case? That we work harder than anyone in the world?
No, we just run our mouths. We don't have to do hard manual labor.
That's exactly right. Well, I wasn't talking about the four of us.
Yeah, you're talking about the United States.
The United States.
Oh,
workers
in
the United States.
Gotcha.
No, the four of us.
I'm just focused on us.
Oh, well, yes. Me too, but I try to broaden my horizon so people don't think it's all about me, even though we know it's all about me. But no, in general, American workers think we work the hardest in the country. While we do work very hard, we do not work the hardest. According to the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, Turkey, the citizens of Turkey work the hardest. Mexico work the second hardest. The United States, where workers average about 34.4 hours a week, comes in at number 16. So we don't quit. We work hard. And here's some troubling numbers. I guess I don't understand it, because you work hard at your job and you're given certain things like vacation days and sick days. And I know a lot of people, we hear all the time, oh, people don't want to take that time off. And it's bearing out in the numbers. Americans, according to a survey, 41% of Americans did not take a single vacation day in 2015. Now, I'm guessing that must include people who don't get paid vacation. And then you can say, well, I don't have the days, I don't take it off. But if you get vacation and you don't take it, I always wonder why.
You're just throwing money out.
Exactly, because most companies, back in the old days, they used to let you roll that over. And if you didn't take your vacation, you could roll it in the next year, or you could cash out or whatever. I remember my dad was a principal with Chicago Public Schools. And back before he retired, and he's passed away a long time, but you could save up your sick days and then cash them out. So when he retired, he had about a year's worth of sick days. So he basically got a year's salary because he never called in sick, even when he was really sick. I think he just wanted to get away from us, my four brothers and myself. I don't blame him for not calling in sick. But Americans aren't doing that anymore. 55% of Americans didn't use all of their vacation days in 2015. Again, 41% didn't take a single day. One-third of employers require employees to work on Thanksgiving, according to a 2015 Bloomberg survey. About 2 in 5 organizations will require employees to work on Christmas or New Year's. And this weekend, Labor Day, 41% of employers will have some staff working on Labor Day. So we are part of that 41%.
It's almost like we can't unplug. It's kind of, you have this idea of you want to take those days, but you're afraid to, almost.
Well,
because you'll have so much to make up.
And you're afraid someone will get your job.
That too.
Right. Yeah, that's why I never call in sick. I'm always afraid somebody's going to take this job.
I just show up sick, for the record.
Do you?
Yeah.
Yeah, you look a little peaked. You did look a little rough today, Sam.
Well, you thought I had sunglasses on like I'm Ray Charles.
Well, I don't know what's going on. Listen, it's not like we have high-def broadcast cameras up there. Plus, you're wearing a hat, and you're in the shadows. You're like lurking, doing sports from under a rock. I don't know what kind of troll-like behavior you want to exhibit on a Labor Day, but you're up there. And I look up, and I see a very shrouded Sam Panionovich.
Is that better? I'm perching now.
Well, listen, I'm here for your content. Your physical physical beauty is not my
The light is
worry.
Turned up all the way. There's a window with the sun shining in it that blocks it.
I understand.
Well, don't all right. Attack the sports camera.
Wow! Did you install it? Are you the one who engineered the cameras? So you're all upset?
I think it's the chickens that he's gotten there.
Yeah, really, the whole thing.
They're really messing the whole situation up.
I don't know if he needs to keep them in the dark so they're calm before he eats them, or what goes on up there. I don't know.
Gonna make us some eggs?
Let's see. Americans are worried about their future. About a quarter of Americans feel that corporate budget cuts and corporate restructuring will limit their job growth potential over the next 5 years. That can't be good. Data from the Economic Policy Institute published last year shows while workers produce more, pay isn't increasing at the same rate. Middle class wages are stagnant and wages of young college grads have been declining since 2000, the report says. And finally, I told you about that we come in number 16th for the amount of hours worked in a week. So there are just a few labor statistics on your Labor Day. And since she's been relaxing for the last few minutes, we might as well put Laura to work. She's got the traffic trouble spots here on 720 WGN. Brian Noonan in for Ro Khan and Anna DeVellantes on 720 WGN. It is Labor Day. Hope you're enjoying yourself. Kids looking a little forlorn today because they know tomorrow is the first day of school. They have to get up early. They have to go and start learning things. It's a rough day. This summer seemed to go very fast. And I was trying to think back, and I don't usually get introspective, which people are like, oh, really? You seem like a guy who's always thinking about what's going on. No, but I was thinking about this summer, and, you know, you get to an age and you think how many summers you've had and how many summers hopefully you have left and if the summer was a good summer or not. And looking back, this summer was fun for us. 312-981-7200. We got a couple minutes before the news. I'd love to hear from you. As you look back on your summer, was it a good summer? Was it a summer that you wish you had maybe done something more that you didn't do? Or did it just go by and you're like, oh no, now it's fall. I have no idea what to do. Because this, being empty nesters, and Kim, you fall into this boat as well. You're
yes,
an empty
I
nester.
Do.
And I'm embracing it now. You've been an empty nester for a little bit, right?
Yeah. Let me think about this. 3 years now.
3 years.
Yeah.
And do you like it?
I do like it. I do like it. I mean, of course I miss my kids and I love having them around, but my husband and I have a good time together.
I'm finding that to be the case, too. Now, our daughter was in L.A. for an internship over the summer, so our empty nest during the school year extended, and I found this summer to be a lot of fun. We went to a bunch of concerts, sat on the lawn at all of them because, you know, we go in economical. We went to the zoo. They had the big zoo lights music things every Friday. We did that. We drove. We had fun, and I was like, oh. This was a summer that, and plus I had the road trip with my daughter to take her out to Los Angeles to see, and we saw the Grand Canyon and all that kind of thing. So this was a top-notch summer.
You had a great summer.
Well,
I follow you on Facebook. I know your every move, Brian Noonan.
I make it way too easy for people to hunt me down and find me. But it was a lot of fun, and there's still that little part of me that. As I adjust to being an empty nester, feels a little guilty that we're having so much fun. But then I'm thinking, well, my daughter's having a ball. So why should we miss out on some fun, too?
Right. Why should we sit home and twiddle our thumbs?
We shouldn't. We should be out doing stuff.
Exactly.
Pretending we're young, vibrant people like Sam in his sunglasses. I don't know what he does when he's out. Did you have a good summer, Sam? Were you covering many sporting events?
Lots going on, yeah. Lots of baseball and lots of good baseball on one side, lots of poor baseball on the other side,
yeah.
If you catch my drift. But yeah, usually out and about and then the weekend morning. So it was.
Plus following your brother's amazing baseball career.
Right, he pitched yesterday. That was actually, it was Saturday. Got my days mixed up. It was his birthday. He pitched 4 scoreless, got the win out of the bullpen on his birthday.
Nice.
Got the win in Montana.
That's awesome.
Very nice.
We all love Montana.
Who doesn't love Montana? I know Maria Osmond sang a song about Meet Me in Montana at one point. It was lovely. Who does he play for again? The Montana Beaver Pelts?
Yeah.
What does he play?
Great guess.
What's the name of the team up there?
Great Falls Voyagers.
The Great Falls Voyagers. That's cool. Do you have the cool minor league hat?
I've got the hat, yeah. It's a V, a red V, and there's a globe rotating around the V.
Oh, nice. I'll tell you what. Minor league logos are phenomenal. For the most part, and it doesn't matter if it's single A, double A, triple A, the minor leagues have really creative marketing, and their logos are terrific.
So you grew up in what town?
Glenwood.
So if Glenwood had a minor league baseball team, you would name it what? Gophers? Giraffes?
I don't know. Does it have to be does an alliteration have to play into it?
My team would. But would this it? Is your team. I forgot.
Yeah. I don't know what mine would be.
Woodpeckers?
The Glenwood Gizmos. And then we'd have that little alien from the Flintstones. The great Gizmo. Wasn't it the great Gizmo? No, he was the great Gazoo. It'd be the Glenwood Gazoos. And we okay. And the hats would be green, and they'd have the little tiny antennas on them.
You should take this to the mayor.
And you play the national anthem.
They wouldn't wear shoes, right?
Right, they don't wear shoes. Well, the fans can't wear shoes. Everybody else, the team can wear shoes, but the fans can't wear shoes. And all the portions at the concession stand are gigantic.
Brontosaurus size.
Yep, and they topple you over. It's fun. George wants to jump in. Hi, George, you're on WGN. Oh, hold on. There you are, George. Hi, George.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
So I heard something. I'm glad you had an opportunity for us to call in. I heard something earlier that I didn't really quite agree with. You said that, you know, you know a lot of people who don't take their vacation days, and how does that not translate into hard workers? I don't really think it's a matter of if you don't take a vacation day, you're a hard worker. I think that us as Americans are so consumed by a billion other things going on in our lives that vacation just seems to become one of those things that we sort of just forget about. And people in other countries have, you know, more of, I guess, traditional lifestyles, and they can sort of they can work vacations into their time.
Yeah, and other countries get a lot more vacation time, and it's a priority there, where here it is definitely not a priority for a lot of people. And I think, you know, I think there's a lot of reasons that people aren't taking it. We touched on a few, that they're afraid to lose their job.
Yeah.
A lot of employers are expecting, you know, their employees to take on more responsibility. And so people are like, well, I can't swing it. I can't leave, even though I'm getting these days.
I was one of those guys. I never took a vacation day, but this summer was the summer. I decided, I said, you know what? Forget it. I quit my job in April, in the beginning of April. And everyone was like kind of going crazy. Why did you quit? It was a great job. Well, you know what? The job is a job. I can get another job. I quit it, and I did all the traveling I wanted to do this year. I mean, I went everywhere.
Nice.
This summer. And I, you know, flew to Europe. I saw my family. I went to 6 countries. From there, I went to Asia, Taiwan, Japan, and then I flew down Malaysia, then to Australia, then Hawaii, and then back. And I'm going to be in South America next week for 2 weeks.
Wow.
And it's just this. I just wanted to do it this summer, putting it off for 10 years, and I finally just did it. And it's just, I should have done it. I should have done it 10 years ago.
Yeah, it sounds wonderful, and it sounds like you know give your life a jump start.
Absolutely, I am so fresh minded right now. It's unreal. I feel so just cleansed and healthy. And I have a job opportunity already. I have another offer already lined up for when I'm gearing up to go back to work. So I mean, it's
excellent.
Like my life didn't even skip a beat.
Sounds great. Well, congratulations, George. Glad your summer turned out that way, and thank you for the call. Let's do this, then it'll be news time on WGN. Work, 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 work. You see me, I'll be work, 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 work. You see me, do me, da, 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 da. Something about that work, 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 work. Brian Noonan in for Rokon and Anna DeVlantes on 720 WGN. Hope you're enjoying your Labor Day, whether you are off or whether you are laboring. We're glad you're with us. There's study, there's science behind this. Half of Americans don't like their jobs. People are unhappy at work, but listen, we have to work. We got to have money. You got to get paid. So people are going to work. They're not happy. That from the Conference Board Research Group. This is something that has been the same since about the year 2000. About half of the workers in the country not happy with their jobs. But it's spilling over, because if you're unhappy at work, a lot of people then carry that over to their personal life, because a lot of us associate who we are with what we do. You know, our job becomes our life. And so if you're unhappy in one, it's going to bleed over and be happy or unhappy in the other areas, which is unbelievable. So there's a lot of advice columns about careers. You read stories about that. There's a lot of that out there about how to find another job, how to be a better interviewer, how to bolster your resume, all that kind of stuff. What there isn't a lot of is advice on how to become happier in your job. And it's not all about changing jobs. It's about being happy in the job you have, even if right now you may be miserable. And I know you're thinking, there's absolutely no way. I despise my job, and no matter what I do, I am not going to be happy. Au contraire, I have some tips. I didn't make these up. These are from social scientists who've done some research on it. But I'm wondering, if you fall into the half of the workers of this country who are unhappy with their job, Let me know what you think you could do to change that. Do you think you have control? Because that's the bottom line of what these researchers found out. We're unhappy because we don't think we control stuff. So have you been in a situation where you were really unhappy with your job and you turned it around? 312-981-7200. And it may be just, we heard from the caller right before we went to the news, George, who just walked away from his job. Sounded like a good job. If he had that kind of money to fund that trip that he described, he must have had a really good job and saved up a bunch of dough. But what did you do? All right, so factors that can tip the scales one way or another for job happiness can boil down to our innate desire for three things. Count these, Joey. Control over our lives, positive daily connections, and joy and meaning in how we spend our work time. That makes sense. So what we can control. People who don't like their jobs, according to this, may even be chronically stressed because, you know, if think about it, every day. Have you ever been in a situation where every day you got up and you dreaded going to work? I was in that situation once, and it was the longest couple years that I've had. It was really stressful for me and my family because it does carry over. There are factors connected with job happiness that we have almost no control over, such as your boss. About half the people who quit their job did so to get away from their manager, according to a Gallup poll. Salaries are important as well, but we don't usually decide, according to this, who our boss is, and they can suddenly change. As for money, studies have showed that it was only a short-term effect on happiness. So here is the most powerful thing you can do, according to this. Take matters into your own hands. These researchers focused on three main factors to deepen workplace satisfaction. And people right now who are dreading going in tomorrow are like, all right, tell it. Is there any way we can have a quick fix? Maybe. One, refining your job to add parts that you like and remove parts that you don't. Two, building better relationships with your colleagues. And three, reframing your job to add meaning and purpose. So I'll explain what that means. Well, number two seems easy, right? Building better relationship with your colleagues. It says if you're interested in the people you work with, ask them questions, things like that. Even if you're not interested, to become more interested in them, you ask them questions. You try to build those relationships. So at least then you feel when you get into that work environment, you have people there that you care about, people there that you like. Are you going to be the best friends in the world? No, but they say, learn more about what others want and help them achieve it. I want to get out of here. All right, I'll help you dig the tunnel. That's, you know, if you're in the joint together, maybe that's what you do. If you're at work, maybe there's something else you want. They say make meetings more fun and engaging. I always bring a puppet to all the staff meetings here. Bring a little puppet. I make them fun and engaging, which is why I haven't gotten an invitation to a staff meeting in a long time. Are we still having those? Am I not? Oh, anyway. Help reduce the length, mandatory attendance, and frequency of those meetings. Instigate off-site gatherings. Hey, you want to go out and grab a coffee? Want to go out and ride a bike? Anything like that? Sure, you could do that. Get lunch. I know a lot of this because, trust me, the first time I read this, I thought to myself, this is all pie in the sky garbage. Because we go to work, we put our head down, and we just, if you don't like your job, you either leave or you grind it out in quiet desperation. And then you go home and you drink or you cry. That's what you do. And then, but as I thought about it more, it makes a little sense. If you can do little bits on your own to create a better environment for you, then suddenly other stuff doesn't affect you as much. So they say just getting to know your colleagues better, which is no harder to do, they say, than asking them questions, deepens your connection to them. If you look forward to interacting with your coworkers, you're going to like your job a lot more as a result. Which is true, because think about it. If you did, I'm not even talking about being neutral with your coworkers. If you just go, oh, there's Bob, he's okay. But if you walk in every day and go, man, that Bob is a pain in my backside. Every day I hear Bob talking, and just the way he stirs his coffee makes me want to take a stir and jam it in his eye. If that's every day, oh my goodness, you can't live like that for more than 20, 30 years. Then it's going to just wear on you. All right, let's go back. Let's go back to this one real quick, to the first one, to number one on this list. Refining your job to add parts you like and remove parts you don't, which on the surface sounds great. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to remove pretty much everything about my job because I don't like any of it. And I'm going to add more pizza time. That's what I want to add to my job. Not me, but just in general. They say you're supposed to make three lists. One, list all the things you currently like about your job, big and small. Everything you like about your job. The second list, you make all the hassles and the headaches of your job. Okay? And then the third list is things you'd like to be able to do in your job, but that you currently don't. So they suggested, you know, take more brainstorming coffee breaks, anything like that. So things you like about your job, the hassles of your job, and things you wish you could do in your job, but you can't. So now you've got these three lists, right? So now you start working on the second two lists. You leave the list you like alone, because that's obviously the list you like. You leave that alone. You start working on the list of hassles and the things that you want to do. So you go, they say go for easy stuff first, just little ones. Then you start subtracting those from list two and putting those in list one. And that you maybe you find something that you like that you run something by your boss and go, hey, I was wondering, I'd like to do this. And your boss goes, okay, that would be fine. And you go, oh, I'm taking that off list three. I'm putting it on list one. Hey, look at list one growing. Suddenly, I seem incrementally happier. Does it happen all at once? No, it could be a slow slog. But maybe you get happier. They say to be imaginative with these lists. Creativity in itself is a well-being booster. Eh, I don't know. Sometimes creativity gives you a headache because your head starts spinning. You hear voices. Anyway, so you get those lists going back and forth. And then things just, you feel better because you see actual proof of change. Your happy list grows. Your sad list goes down. And then your other lists kind of stay the same. All right. And the last one, which we will get to on the other side, is creating a new job title in your head. It's right now I'm the emperor, and it's very exciting. I sat down here, I created a whole new job title for myself. I'll explain what that means, and I want to hear from you too, 312-981-7200. Do you love your job? Do you hate your job? Which side of the equation do you fall on? And how have you decided to cope if you are in that half of American workers that is unhappy in their work? How have you coped with it to this point? I want to hear from you. But first, I want to hear from Laura Vaughn because traffic is insane at the end of a holiday weekend. She's got the trouble spots. Wow, I have not heard Rush Working Man in quite some time. I like it. Very nice. Thank you, Joey. Joey Gelman bringing the rock today. It's like a block party weekend.
Always.
Working Man songs. All right, so we're talking about falling in love with a job you don't even like. Three simple steps. And when I say simple, I cross my fingers and hope that they're simple. We've already covered two of the steps. The first one was, of course, to hack your job, to make the three charts, to make the three lists, what you love about your job, things that are hassles about your job, and things at your job that you'd like to do but aren't currently doing. And then you work on the second and third list to add those, to subtract from those lists and add to the first list. The second thing was then enjoying your work neighbors, asking questions, getting invested a little bit in the people you work with so that you can enjoy seeing them for 8 to 10 hours a day instead of walking in and just cringing like, oh, if Joey even looks at me today, I swear there's going to be trouble. So the third thing is create a new job title in your head. These two social scientists did a research. Part of their research was focusing on a group of people who are on a hospital cleaning staff. Now, that would seem like a rough job, right? And a thankless job. And a job a lot of people would go, well, it doesn't take a lot of creativity, maybe. Might not be the happiest job in the world, but it's a job, and it's a steady job. It's a good job, I guess. What they found was that a significant factor among those who reported liking that job was how they, quote-unquote, cognitively framed it. That's when we get into some psychological words. The work was the same for everybody, but while some thought of it, Some thought it was comprised of uncreative tasks. Those who liked the work thought of themselves as playing a critical role in healing patients. One person considered him or herself an ambassador. So in their mind, they had changed it from, I'm just a guy or a woman who changes sheets and cleans bedpans, to, I am a critical cog in the healing process of these patients. So now it instills a little more pride in their work. It instills a bigger sense of importance in their work, and they can be happier doing it. It's a change in your behavior if you approach your job. If you think, I'm an ambassador to the hospital, it changes what you do. For example, you may be cleaning bedpans, but if you think of yourself as a caregiver, you may be looking at what's in the bedpan for signs of health problems to alert the nurse. You don't think, I can't do that, said the social scientist. That's where the action really comes in. Okay, but I don't know if I want to trust my well-being to the person who is cleaning up, but I guess maybe if they see something that they find odd, should there be a gopher in here? Oh, no. Thank you for bringing that to my attention. Well, you're welcome. I'm an ambassador. I'm trying to keep people healthy.
But I think reframing is absolutely key. I like that idea of it, because while I don't think you can necessarily get maybe rid of the bad parts of the job or get rid of that official bad list.
Right.
If you can build up that other side of repurposing what your goals are and find different avenues to show your creative side or show your intuition on a certain project or task that can kind of elevate that side a little more.
Right.
Just thinking that you've done that and executing it can kind of shift your mind a little bit and say, hey, this is maybe as bad as it is. There's a lot to take from if you can find that little thing you can latch on to.
Right, and it doesn't mean have delusions of grandeur. It means
no.
Take pride in what you do and,
right.
And look at it in a bigger picture. Don't look at yourself as pigeonholed, well, I only can do this, whereas you could say, well, I'm part of a bigger thing. You know, I'm helping create this entire process, and I'm an important part of it. Shifting the paradigm around their job and adding meaning and purpose, the hospital staff made the tougher parts of their job tolerable, even important, and changed their behavior to support that purpose. So it asks if you can do that with your job, and that's a question it has for you. Can you do this with your job? Think about the part you play in a larger framework that has a positive effect on others. How is your commitment to accuracy and detail vital to the effectiveness of the data for your job? You may perform rote tasks in a factory, but are you helping build something that people need or bring others joy? So if that's the case, all you have to do, whatever your job accomplishes, there is also meaning and purpose with what you do to your wages. So there you go. Just, you know, think about it. And I know we focused a lot on jobs this first hour, but it's Labor Day. People are working, and I know this stat is troubling and probably very accurate that mostly half of people don't like their job. You know who's not going to like their job? The librarians in Athens Limestone, Alabama. Who even knew that there were libraries in Alabama? But there are, and people are using them. The problem is people are using them and then not returning things. And so now, in an effort to recoup about $200,000 worth of overdue materials, the Athens Limestone Public Library will be enforcing an ordinance that prescribes fines and jail time for people with overdue library books. That's the sentence you do not want to be telling other inmates about when you go to the clink. What are you in for? Armed robbery. What are you in for? I stole a car. What are you in for? I didn't return a book. You
they
heard
have
me.
Candles in Alabama?
No, people are going to the library. They enjoy it. The city, I don't know. I guess if they had Kindles, they wouldn't need to go to the library.
They wouldn't go to jail.
Well, sure, but then
buy a Kindle, stay out of jail.
Maybe they don't have the money. Maybe they steal the Kindle. Then they go to jail for longer.
At least you stole something.
Well, if you steal from, if you don't return something to the library, you stole it.
Maybe you're just borrowing it for a little longer.
No, I'll tell you, they give you a chance, ample opportunity for these scofflaws to make right. The city ordinance says it's unlawful for any person who has a library card to, quote, fail or refuse to return, end quote, any materials borrowed or withdrawn from the public library. Person who violates the ordinance may receive a fine of up to $100, be sentenced to a city jail term of 30 days or possibly both at the discretion of the municipal judge. You better hope the judge is having a good day that day. The library director said they're resorting to enforcing this ordinance because offenders are not only stealing from the library, but also from other library patrons and taxpayers. What is going on in Alabama? I haven't been to a library in a long time. But if this rampant disregard for library rules in Alabama, what is going on?
They hate their jobs.
I guess. So they're taking it on the library mm-hmm. book? The taxpayers expect us to protect our investment, said the library director. She explained that the library would much rather have the overdue materials back than the associated fines. One reason why the library has offered programs in the past to help collect overdue materials. See? So it all just keeps going. A patron may have several hundred dollars worth of library materials. A patron can check out up to 25 items at a time. That seems excessive right there. I'm gonna say that's the root of your problem. You don't let somebody take out 25 items at a time. First of all, who's going to read 25 books at one sitting? Take out two or three.
They need the library cop from Seinfeld badly.
If everybody who went into the library at the Athens Limestone Public Library took out 25 items, that library has got to be empty in like 2 days. So now you got librarians sitting in a big empty building just echoing their voices off the steel cabinets where the books should be. That makes absolutely no sense. All right, so you're going to go to jail if you don't return your books. Just return your. But they said, I will tell you this, they're not going to send little kids to jail. They're not going to point out that they're not going after five-year-olds with overdue copies of Clifford the Big Red Dog. Only a small percentage of patrons do not return materials as agreed. The policy will only affect the really, really bad people. All right, let's do this, and it's news time on WGN.
I was born to a crowd of 47,000 cheering people. I've played in the Astrodome, Madison Square Garden, and Wrigley Field. But I'm not an athlete. I've jammed with Chuck Berry, Paul McCartney, and the Ramones, even Elvis Presley. But I'm not a rock star. I've been on Snyder, Costas, and Letterman, appeared in movies and commercials, but I'm not an actor. I've met with governors, senators, and representatives. I've been summoned by Presidents Ford, Reagan, and Bush, but I'm not a politician. I've appeared in 8 countries, 4 continents, 50 states in front of 60 million people and signed over 2 million autographs, but my face is completely unknown. My name is Ted Giannoulis, but to you, I am the famous chicken.
Brian Noonan in for Ro Khan and Anna DeVellantes on 720 WGN. And yes, he is. He is the famous chicken, the San Diego chicken, the man who has been entertaining crowds for over 40 years. And he joins us now on WGN. Ted, thanks for taking some time this afternoon. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thank you, Brian. I appreciate the invitation to be on the show with you. Thanks.
Well, I saw a really nice write-up on you last week in the New York Times, and I've seen you perform a couple times in person, and it's always been great. And I thought, you know what? Because the article kind of hinted that you're not ready to retire, but it might not be far off. And you've brought joy to so many people, and yet we don't really know who you are. So I wanted to talk to you, and I'm glad you had some time today.
You know, it's something I've always enjoyed doing, and I've been doing it now for 42 years, and I still get a kick out of it. It's an Only in America story.
It definitely is. So how did this story start? How did you first don a chicken suit?
Yeah, believe it or not, it started off as a radio station promotion. Back in 1974, a local rock and roll station in town here wanted to dress somebody up in a chicken suit for $2 an hour, sent him to the zoo during the Easter break to pass out candy Easter eggs.
Okay.
Problem was at the station, nobody wanted to do this detail, so they dispatched a representative to the campus of San Diego State to find the first college kid that would agree to do this. By happenstance, I crossed paths with him. I volunteered to do it, $2 an hour. I went and did the zoo thing, but then I figured, you know, being a big sports fan, I bet I could get into the Padre games for free with this.
Good scam.
Yeah, so I called them up, they let me come down, and then I started cavorting around, fans had fun with it, and the rest was chicken history.
So you go to the Padres, and what's your pitch to them? Hey, I've got this suit, and were you still working for the radio station at this time, and were they behind it?
Yes, and they were very much for it. I mean, it was pretty unprecedented. Back then, fans did not show up in outrageous outfits or face paint or anything of that nature. And so I was basically a walk-around billboard. That's how the station saw it. It was really an innovation in what is now known as guerrilla marketing. And so to advertise a station on a chicken suit, their call letters, I just started cavorting around at the Jack Murphy Stadium. And to amuse myself and to draw even more attention, I just started doing comedic bits. And it just took off from there, and the Padres really encouraged me more and more with each passing homestand.
So the Padres like what you're doing. The radio station at this point is behind you. At what point do you and the radio station kind of have a parting of the ways?
Oh, yeah, they fired me about 5 years later. But in the interim, Brian, what happened was that the character had built up a virtual a following, a cult following, so to speak, in town. And for that matter, other teams across the country started inviting me in for their fans as well. So there's almost this groundswell as it became a box office attraction. Kind of unusual, but it was working out, where people were coming out to see this comedic show in the context of a live sporting event. And so they fired me in 1979, and then they filed a lawsuit to prevent me from branching out on my own.
Oh.
But to make a story short, the courts ruled in my favor and made me a free agent chicken.
Everybody likes free agent chickens. They're supposed to be much better because they're not cooped up. So now I want to get to a lot of other stuff. But the rebirth after the court rules that you are a free chicken, the rebirth of the chicken that night at the Padres game was an enormous event, right?
Yes. In fact, sports historians have called it one of the greatest sports promotions of all time. It was June 1979. I was making my comeback on this particular evening. Sold out the entire stadium. 47,000 people had turned out for this grand hatching. What I had is create this large styrofoam egg, and I was brought out on an armored truck with California Highway Patrol escort, believe it or not.
Oh,
the Padre team lowered the egg from on top of the armored truck onto the field, and I hatched out of this styrofoam egg to a standing ovation, and the Padres even carried me off the field. it was a remarkable event, to say so myself.
It is. It's an amazing thing. As you said, it's an only in America kind of story. And now, 42 years into this, Ted, you have to look back and wonder, how did this all catch on? The timing must have just been perfect because, as you said, professional teams weren't doing this kind of thing before. And all of a sudden, now every team has some sort of wild mascot.
Yeah, that's a good point, Brian. Even the Olympics make a big deal out of having a character. But you hit on something there. The timing, I think, really helped, because what was happening at the time, cable was breaking out for the first time, and as teams televised from San Diego their games back home, I was getting a little more exposure. So this was a kind of a groundbreaking to begin with. I mean, there was beyond WGN, there was the Superstation starting up, and all
right.
These other stations as well. And then, in addition, I've got to say, irreverent comedy was taking a new shape. Saturday Night Live in the 70s was taking form, and there were these breakout comedians like Robert Klein, Steve Martin, Richard Pryor, of course, George Carlin. They were all approaching comedy with different aspects. And so what I was doing, I saw myself as a fuzzy Harpo Marx in the context of what I was doing at a sporting event. And so I took my fascination for comedy, merged it with my love for sports, and produced this unique act at a time where media was finding new ground itself.
And then was it hard? Now, San Diego, you said the Padres loved it, and you built a huge following there. When did other teams and other venues start approaching you and go, hey, Ted, we'd like to bring – and it – it's still the San Diego. You're still the San Diego chicken, right? As well as the famous chicken, but it's the San Diego chicken.
Yes, correct. Correct. And really, this is interesting to note, Brian. It started really gaining a lot of notoriety with the players themselves. Believe it or not, I hate to say this in Chicago, but the St. Louis Cardinals the players actually called me up one day in 1976 and asked me if I would come to visit them in St. Louis for a couple of home games. These are the players.
Oh, that's funny.
Told me, it called me up at the radio station I was working at and said they're going to forego their kangaroo court money for the party at the end of the season and instead would like to buy me a round-trip airfare ticket to fly me into St. Louis so I could perform and, you know, and so that they could have one last laugh of the summer. I agreed to do this. They flew me in. This is Lou Brock, Keith Hernandez, you know, all those guys. And they flew me in, and I did a two-game set there. And it was from there, it just caught a lot of attention, you know, with a lot of other teams, especially in the front offices.
Ted Gianulis is my guest. You know him as the San Diego Chicken. Ted, can you hang on?
Of course. Yeah.
All right. I got it. Because I have to talk to you about being on stage with Elvis, and we've got a lot more to talk about. Ted Gianulis, the San Diego Chicken, is with us. It's people are running around like chickens with their head cut off on the highways. Laura Vaughn has all the traffic trouble spots on WGN.
Here's a good one, fellas. I go up to the umpire, and I whip out the eye chart.
Oh, yeah, that's a classic. What I miss? Just a refresher course on chicken stick.
Chicken stick?
Yeah, chicken stick.
Don't miss the famous chicken when your Padres take on the San Francisco Giants. On Friday, August 1st, be entertained by the famous chicken. And on Saturday, August 2nd, get a Padres fan-selected T-shirt.
And then the umpire rips my feathers off.
Brian Noonan in for Ro Khan and Anna DeVlantes on 720 WGN, and I am talking to the famous chicken, the San Diego Chicken, the one and only Ted Gianulis, who has been entertaining crowds for over 40 years. No sign of slowing. Well, you're slowing down a little. You're taking a little more time to yourself, Ted, which is good. At your peak, how many performances were you doing a year?
I was doing about 250 games a year around the world and nationwide. So I was out there crossing a lot of roads, so to speak.
Yeah, how about that? That is crazy. Chicken to crossing the road to get everywhere. And when did you decide, you know what, I'm 63. I've been doing this a long time. I'm not going to give it up, but I'm going to start tapering back a little bit.
I would say about the last 5 to 7 years, I started dropping it back quite a bit, Brian, you know, and started having other life experiences for a change. I literally was devoting every second of my waking being to the betterment of the chicken act somehow.
Yeah.
And I enjoy it. I got to tell you, I love it. I could never put it down. But, you know, as you progress, sometimes you figure, you know, you got to have some other life experiences.
Sure.
And my wife reminded me of that quite often.
And before we let you go, I got to ask about the night you were on stage with Elvis. How does the San Diego Chicken end up on stage with the King?
It's one of my favorite stories, believe it or not, and it's not as well known. But in about, I'd say, 16, 18 months before he passed away, he was doing a concert here in San Diego. And as it was, I used to attend all the concerts, again, representing the local rock and roll radio station here. And so I'm figuring, okay, I've got to make my mark here because a lot of bands would normally bring me up on stage with them.
Okay.
Well, on this particular night, Elvis is breaking into a song of the Jerry Lee Lewis cover of Whole Lot of Shaking Going On. And there's a line in that song, "We got chicken in the barn."
Who's right.
Barn? Barn, my barn. So I'm thinking, this is my move. So I'm at the back of the sports arena. And so I decide I'm going to dart all the way up to the front of the stage and start dancing underneath Elvis while he's singing the song. Now, Elvis sees this, Brian, okay, and he starts in hysterics. He starts laughing so hard, he has to drop the one knee. He loses his lyrics. He's laughing so hard, and the band behind him can't see, but they start playing softly. They're thinking Elvis is having a seizure. Lo and behold, this doctor even comes onto the stage
with
a black bag, the famous Dr. Nick, and attempts to get Elvis to lie down. Elvis is laughing so hard, the tears are in his eyes. You can see it from the Klieg lights. He's pushing the doctor away while he has a stethoscope out, trying to get Elvis again to lie down. Elvis points to me. Then the doctor understands that Elvis is laughing. He collects himself, the bag, exits the doctor. He goes, Elvis gets back up. He signals to the band, keep going. He finishes the song. And then after the applause, it was a great moment. He turns to the audience. He says, ladies and gentlemen, I don't know if you can all see back there, but you got to believe me, there's a chicken dancing up here in front of the stage. And, of course, the audience understands, but then Elvis comes up with a great line. He says, I don't know who put the chicken up to this, but I want to warn him. My manager's name is the Colonel. And
Perfect.
Out of the sports arena, and that's where security caught up to me and literally hauled me out by all four limbs. Out to the parking lot.
Well, Ted, that's just one of the many stories that I'm sure we could share. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Congratulations. No plans to retire permanently in the near future, correct?
Not in the foreseeable future.
All right.
I'm still going for the last laugh somewhere.
Good deal. Well, we'll be looking for you at a ballpark anywhere in the country. It has been a pleasure to talk to you, and continued success, Ted. Thanks very much.
I appreciate it, Brian. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's Ted Giannoulis. He is the San Diego Chicken. You can go to famouschicken.com to get all his information. Let's do this. Then it's news time on WGN. It's Brian Noonan in for Rokan and Enid Vellantes on 720 WGN. Rock and Roll High School, Rock and Roll Grade School. Everything starts tomorrow for the Chicago Public School System. If you have a child in CPS, you know that. You may be excited. The kids, hopefully they're very excited. We'll see. Some more good news coming out of CPS this morning. And Janice Jackson joins us now. She is the Chief Education Officer for the Chicago Public Schools. Janice, thanks for taking some time this afternoon. Appreciate it.
Brian, I appreciate you giving me the opportunity.
So I'm sure the kids are thinking, boy, summer went very fast. We're already coming back. How does the administration feel? Are you guys ready for the influx of students tomorrow?
Absolutely. We're ready and excited as always. As a former teacher and principal, the beginning of the school year is always so, you know, exciting for me. But I think for many of our parents and students, they're just, you know, happy to be going back to school, and hopefully they appreciate the fact that the district is in a much more stable place than it was last year at this time. So I think people are excited, ready to go. I know the principals are all set to welcome students and teachers back to school tomorrow.
And I know tomorrow is going to be a hot day. We've been hearing all summer about the new air conditioning units are being put in some of the schools that don't have air conditioning. So things are starting to improve physically, too.
They are. And I think what's important to note is that the issue of air conditioning in Chicago public schools is an issue that's about 50 years old. But under Mayor Emanuel's administration, we've really accelerated that. And we have just under 60 schools who still require those air conditioners. And we plan to have those installed very quickly. Of course, principals will have to use their discretion this week. We are looking forward to a few hot days, but we'll make sure our students are comfortable and ready to learn.
Let's go with the good news that came out this morning about the graduation rates for CPS up from last year. I want to ask, before we get into the actual numbers, part of it is the stats are for 5 years. And can you explain that? Because most of us, myself included, went, well, high school is 4 years. Why is there a five-year?
You know, actually, we do both. We publish both a four-year rate and a five-year rate, and we do it for a couple of different reasons. Number one, the four-year rate is really how many students graduate on time at the end of 4 years. So how many students start off as freshmen and complete high school by June of, you know, 4 years after that in June. However, the five-year rate gives us an opportunity to account for students who graduate after June.
Okay.
Most of those students finish during summer school. And as a former principal, I know that for a lot of children, they just need that extra opportunity. And then we have thousands more students who spend an extra semester or possibly another year in order to secure that degree. So we publish both just to be transparent. On the one hand, we know that the public wants to know how many children have graduated on time, but we also want to give students and schools the opportunity to showcase how many students they were able, you know, to get over that threshold and that benchmark.
Well, in last year, about 1,400 more students received a diploma than the year before. Said you, in a story I read in the paper today, you talked about the neighborhood schools being one of the biggest reasons that this happened. What, explain that.
Yeah, if you take a look, when we publish our date, we always give a school-by-school analysis. And it's no surprise that some of our top schools like Peyton, Westinghouse continue to lead us, Whitney Young, in graduation rates. Mm-hmm. But if you look a little bit deeper, you'll see a few trends that are really promising. Number one, every geographic network throughout the city from the north side to the south side saw an increase. So that speaks to just quality throughout. And then second, our neighborhood high schools, which traditionally have been schools with much lower rates, have actually been able to kind of turn things around. So if you do a school-by-school analysis, some of the schools who have traditionally had rates, you know, far below the district average have really been able to cut that variance down. So we're really excited about that. And I think it bodes well for neighborhood schools, which sometimes do not get the respect and the credit for the hard work that they do.
Well, sure, everybody looks at the magnet schools, and you listed those earlier. So what is it about, what are the neighborhood schools doing differently? Because I'm guessing the curriculum is the same. The teachers are all dedicated as all. So where is the change coming?
Actually, I would say that as far as curriculum goes, we have made some improvements over the past 5 years, which I think are notable. Number one, we've increased the amount of schools who fall into program categories that have, you know, higher rates of student success. So you've seen IB programs grow by over 200%. You've seen some of the selective enrollment seats increase, military seats, some of the STEM schools. So we've doubled down on academic programs that have a strong curriculum that result in more kids finishing school. We've also aggressively implemented the Common Core standards, which are a national set of standards, which are much more rigorous than some of those that we've used in the past. And I think that that accounts for some of that. But I think the most important thing would be just principals and teachers putting systems in place to support our children. We now track something called Freshmen on Track, which we learned from the University of Chicago is a pretty good indicator of how well students will do in high school. And what that does is it gives the schools an early warning list for students as early as ninth grade, so that the right interventions can be in place so that those kids can be on track to graduate. I think those three things have been the major contributors to our success as a district.
Now, a lot of good news coming out of this report. There's still some schools, though, that are struggling. What, as you look at that, where do you see changes? What changes do you think need to be made to bring those schools up with these others?
Yeah, some of our schools, especially those that experience under enrollment, high levels of mobility, they haven't seen the outcomes that we would like to see in, you know, the things that we've seen throughout the city. I think number one, they need access to high quality programs like the programs I listed earlier. Obviously, there are financial constraints around, you know, growing those programs as aggressively as we would like to. But I know that for some of our neighborhood high schools or schools that, you know, have had difficulty recruiting students, they really need programs and curriculum that attract students and families back to their schools. I think we live in a very different age now where parents have choice, students have choice, and they know that. And so they're really savvy in looking at schools and looking at the curriculum that they offer and making those decisions. So what we need to do is ensure that there is more equity throughout the district and that some of those schools that have traditionally been left behind have access to the programs that I talked about earlier.
And that's got to be very difficult in this economic climate where you say, I mean, that makes sense. Okay, we've got to give all the schools equal opportunity to these programs. But we all know that in this state, the money's just not there. So how then does the district make that up to these schools?
Yeah, well, you know, it is a hard balancing act. Number one, we try to be as strategic as possible, given the limited resources. We know that our academic gains are only as good as our financial and fiscal you know, standing. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes we do have to be really strategic, and that means that certain schools get an investment while others, that investment may be delayed until we can support every school. But I think one of the things that's important to note is that we have made more investments in our neighborhood high schools. If you look at where we place the IB schools in particular, we've looked at neighborhood high schools as our first place, mm-hmm. knowing that there's already strong curricular in place at our selective enrollment schools. We've looked at schools like Taft, schools like Amundsen, and other neighborhood high schools as sites for the IB program. So we've made some steady progress, but we still have a ways to go, obviously.
Are there certain segments of students that are doing better? Are there still some segments of students that are struggling with the graduation rate?
Yeah, as you can imagine, the achievement gap does still exist. I mean, obviously, it's an issue in public education throughout the country, and Chicago is no different. But if you look at the rates for African-American males, unfortunately, they still lag behind their African-American female peers and other male peers. However, we have seen some glimmer of hope amongst our non-EL Latino students. We've seen dramatic increases in the amount of students completing high school. We've also seen dramatic increases in test scores amongst this group as well. So while the achievement gap is still something that we struggle with as a large urban school district, we have seen in a few places a glimmer of hope in students beating the odds.
And let's look at tomorrow, first day of school. There's been reports this week about adding 4 new safe zones. How has the safe zone program been working out?
The Safe Passage program is one of the most successful programs in the district, and I'm happy you asked about that. So we increased a few routes this year, namely at Al Raby High School on the west side in the East Garfield Park community, but also at the new Diet High School, which is set to reopen, and everybody's waiting with a lot of excitement around that. But one data point that I could share with you to talk about the importance of the Safe Passage program would be the attendance rates. Prior to Safe Passage, the average daily attendance rate at those schools was around 86%. Since Safe Passage has been instituted, now it's around 92-93%. Wow. So what that tells us is clearly students will come to school if they feel more safe and secure on that route. And we know that for a lot of our children, they're able to come to school and do remarkable things despite great odds. So anything we can continue to do to level that playing field or make them feel more secure is something that I know CEO Claypool and I believe we should be doing, and definitely Mayor Emanuel believes we should be doing.
And the Safe Passage monitors, those are all volunteers, correct?
Oh, no, they're paid employees. They're paid employees, okay. Absolutely. Many of them are community residents, parents, and other, you know, just concerned residents in the community who really want to help out, and they do it part-time, but it really helps to have a familiar face who knows the community. They know who's supposed to be there, who shouldn't be there, and they have great relationships with the local police as well as the local schools, so that line of communication is clear, and I think that that has resulted in students being able to get to and from school with fewer incidents than what we've seen in the past.
Well, that number you gave is definitely an indicator that the program is working, as you said.
Yeah.
We always hear today, and we've heard the last couple of days, you know, how important attendance is on the first day. And the message that CPS puts out every day, make sure, parents, that you get your kids to school on the first day. And most of us know that it's somehow tied to federal funding. Explain why it's so important, not only for the students' education, which is obvious, but how important is it for the district to make sure that everybody's in class tomorrow?
Well, definitely there are financial implications. We, you know, when students don't enroll in school on the first day, it's much more difficult to track their attendance, to track where they are. And when we're in a position to report our average daily attendance to the state, you know, it does pose some issues. But I think the real story is around the educational value. There is research that shows that students who not only miss the first day of school, but if students are chronically truant, they're less likely to be successful in school, and that's on a number of different indicators. Their test scores, graduation rates, there are large disparities for students who attend school on a regular basis and those that do not. So I think for parents, it's always about making sure they're aware of that. I know that there are always extenuating circumstances where children can't attend school, but I would just encourage people to send them to school daily unless there, you know, is a really, really, really compelling reason for them to stay home, because the research is clear that if students miss more than 9 days, that they're going to be off track towards graduation, and it's much more difficult to get them back on track once that has occurred.
Get to school. And before I let you go, Janice, I have to ask, because everybody's been following the story. Obviously, the district and the teachers still talking. Everything's on track. We're hoping for a full year, no interruptions.
Yeah, that's everybody's goal. We continue to negotiate with the union in good faith. I think it's important to remind folks that we did have a tentative deal on the table back in January that gave teachers a generous raise and was also something that improved upon a lot of the quality of life issues that they reported being most important to them. So the district was able to make good on a lot of those promises. So I'm hopeful that as we approach the beginning of the school year, we're able to, reach a resolution. I know as a parent with a student in CPS that it's really, really critical that there's a resolution so that everybody can just be optimistic about this school year.
Definitely agree with that. Janice, we appreciate the time. Thanks so much. Have a great year and good luck tomorrow.
All right. Thank you for the opportunity. Happy Labor Day.
Happy Labor Day to you. That's Janice Jackson. She is the chief education officer for the Chicago Public Schools. Right now, if you were trying to get your kid to school, you'd just be sitting because the roads are a nightmare. Laura Vaughn has all the traffic trouble spots. All right. On the other side of the news, we're going to talk a little. Oh, there's been a lot of shakeups in the Bears lineup. Big, big news. So Sam will join us, talk a little bit about that. First day of school tomorrow. Oh, I always think back to my first day of school and my academic career. I don't know about you guys. I'm guessing Sam and Laura and Kim and Joey all did very well in school. I was not a good student. But every year on this day, I would make the pledge. This is the year. I'd look at all my new school supplies. I'd be ready to go. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to go to the bus stop. I'm going to go to school. Everything's going to be different. Fast forward to next week. Nah, I had no desire. None. Were you a good student, Kim? I'm betting you were a great student.
I was a good student.
Yeah, of course.
No, I loved school.
So, my daughter's the same way. And I liked going to school. I liked seeing my friends, and I found certain things interesting. But then there was stuff that I just didn't find interesting, and I didn't, But I always went. Did you ever ditch? You ever cut class? Did you really?
When I was in high school, I wasn't perfect, Brian. And I did not like math. And math was not my strong suit. So I was a good student except for math.
Math, you know what? I am horrible in math. I think people in our chosen field, probably a lot of us were not real good in math. Whereas people, I have friends who are accountants and in the financial industry, and they have, they can't really put too many sentences together because their mind works a whole different way.
Well, three of us, just to give you an idea about how bad we are in math up here, three of us today were trying to figure out how many minutes it would take if Steve would be long or short on this business, and we were all wrong.
Really?
Yeah. We thought he was going to be way over, and it ended up to be 2 minutes short. So what does that tell you?
It tells me that everybody listening is not like, boy, those news people, we used to think they were geniuses. Now they can't even add up 60-second increments.
They cannot.
And Kim is a finger counter, too. She's always using her fingers to count.
There's nothing wrong with that.
I am, too.
I see the little kids in school doing that. You know how I finger count? I just type it into a calculator. That's how I finger count.
Which is now your cell phone, right? Because your cell phone is now a calculator.
No, I actually carry an old Texas Instrument calculator. Oh. I am old school that way, Sam.
The TI-83 or whatever.
That's right. Yeah. So I could type out 7411 and then turn it over and go, look at that.
No,
what do you think of that?
I know what you're talking about.
All right, 4311 I think it would be. Anyway, it's news time now, and then we're going to talk a little Bears after that. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNradio.com. The news is sponsored by Fog U Mold. 5 o'clock, Kim Gordon.
From 41 yards away.
All right.
This is for the win. Robbie Gould's kick is good.
Why did I know Joey was going to go with that, with some Bear Down? It's Brian Noonan in for Rokon and Anna DeVlantes. Ro and Anna will be back tomorrow. They are just enjoying their Labor Day, and I'm enjoying my Labor Day here with you on WGN and with my good pal Sam Panionovich, who's been manning the sports desk all day, doing a yeoman's job as always.
Yo!
Good to see you. This is Well, I was here last night when this news came out, and I think I was like every Bears fan and went, well, yeah, he struggled a little toward the end of the season, but isn't this just a budgetary cut? I was shocked. Were you surprised when Robbie Gould was let go?
See, the numbers haven't been good. The accuracy's been down, and Ryan Pace is showing you how important analytics are for his regime. He looked at the field goals under 40 yards.
Right.
And he addressed this today, talked for 15 minutes at Hallis Hall, talked about how, on a personal level, it's always tough to make a cut. Mm-hmm. That being said, though, when you need 3 points in the worst way and your kicker's missing from 33, from 30, remember he
missed
couple years ago?
Six of the last 24 kicks.
Against the Vikings, they should have won the game. He missed from,
Redskins
38 yards. He was missing a lot of kicks, and he's going to bring in somebody that he feels can do the job better. Now, Robbie kicked for 11 years here.
Yeah.
There's longevity. Do you remember the kicker he replaced, by the way? Can you go that far back?
2004? I know they came back. The guy was injured, and they brought Robbie in. I can't remember.
He used to turn to the side when he would kick. Paul Ettinger.
Oh.
He used to turn and then wheel around
like
and
Olay?
Kick. Yeah, kind of like an Olay type deal. So it's been good as gold for 11 years.
That's not bad. And he's going to get picked up, don't you think, by somebody?
You would think so, although his path to the NFL was a little slow. They signed him, the Bears did, when he was 24. He was working construction.
Right. He had been with the Patriots at first, right? Wasn't he signed by them at first?
They may have signed him. He never played a game until he was 24 with the Bears. So that was a long run. We just mentioned it in the sports. 276 field goals made. He was an 85% kicker. But
well, even
recently,
last year,
I think they didn't believe him.
Right. He still met his average or came like within...
He was 84.6 last
year. Right, so he was right at his percentage, basically. Last year, but then preseason he was missed a couple, and so that's basically where it comes. How much of this was salary related? Because he was going to make a $500,000 roster bonus. He was up for another big raise. He was going to be one of the top paid kickers in the league. Is it a combination of both those things? Did they need to free up some money to bring in this new guard from the Packers?
You know, dollars and cents, I think they got cheaper, obviously, with the kicking. I don't think they cut him solely because of what he made, though. Right. That wouldn't be ideal. It's bad business if you just cut somebody based on what they make. But now, Brian, you look at this offensive line, which was a huge question mark, I don't know, 3 days ago, you bring in Josh Sitton, who won 3 Pro Bowls with the Packers. He's left guard. Kyle Long is right guard. They're both extremely physical. They're going to knock you on your ass, and that opens up the running game, hopefully, and they can protect Jay Cutler.
Robbie Gould tweeted last night, thank you to the Bears organization, teammates, coaches, and fans. Once a Bear, always a Bear. Hashtag Bear Down. So always a classy guy when he was here. You never heard a bad thing about him. And then, now he's off to do whatever his next chapter is.
The numbers for you now, the Bears will pay their 2 guards $17.5 million between Kyle Long and Josh Sitton.
Really? $17.5 million?
Yeah, for 2 offensive linemen.
Wow. That seems pretty cheap.
Right? Well, you make that money when you get rid of Gold, right?
Yeah, you said your kicker away, your good as gold kicker away, and then you bring in these other guys. So what do we know? This kicker is coming in from the Saints. He's also been in Denver. So the Ryan Pace said, listen, the coaches who were here from Denver know him. They're
and
confident.
Pace,
him. Pace knows him from New Orleans, of course. So they're confident that this guy can do the job. What a lot of columnists that I've been reading and a lot of sports reporters, and perhaps you were wondering the same, if they're so big on analytics, they looked at Gold's stats from last year. Why didn't they bring anybody in to camp? Why didn't they? Because it seemed like it blindsided not only him, but it blindsided the fans as well, where you go, okay, if there had been a competition, you never know. But this seemed like, okay, he's here for another year.
This seemed like something that they have been putting off. It seemed like that they thought it was inevitable. But I agree with you because if you know in the back of your mind that you're trying to spring Robbie Gould out of town, wouldn't you like to have a competition of multiple kickers that would come in and at least push him or maybe rise to the top? I think the bar thing has been under the wraps for a while. I think maybe Ryan Pace extended out a feeler maybe a couple months back and said, hey, how you feeling? What are you doing? I'm sure they've been scouting him.
Oh,
they're tremendous scouters. They probably worked him out. So the timing is the only questionable thing, because if you're Robbie Gould and he took the high road on Twitter, you even read the tweet. He tweeted last night, it's a depressing picture. It's Hallis Hall, the entrance at night.
Right.
Which is
like
very,
they just called him, like he was going in for a meeting. Well, hey, guys, click.
Yeah, hopefully he got a couple others in before they plowed him out of there. Yeah, security!
Right. Pack up your stuff. But I would go.
Yeah, it's a little tacky to me to cut an 11-year player from your team when the season opens on Sunday.
Yeah, are these – now, you understand the Josh Sitton thing, bringing him in this late, because he was just – he was the last cut from the Packers.
He fell into their laps.
Right, this is a guy you have to jump on fast. And Ryan Pace said that they had been, you know, not only division-wise, but they scout everybody. It just so happened they knew everything about him, and so –
because he's been killing them
right,
for
exactly.
the last, you know, 6 years.
So they go, okay, we got to get this guy right away. But with Barth, is he going to have time? And granted, the scheme for kickers is probably a whole lot simpler than the scheme for anybody else. So it shouldn't be that much of an adjustment. But it is strange. The opener is Sunday.
Right. It'll be strange mostly because you've been able to see number 9 put the ball through the uprights for 11 seasons in a row. Most kickers don't last that long. You're lucky to last 4 or 5 years in one spot. You know, there's the rare guys, the Vinatieris, who play forever. I think he's almost 40, or he is 40 years old now. So, you know, the kicking game is a very wishy-washy field. You make them, you stay. You miss them, you're gone.
Yeah, there's not a lot of room to hide when you're the kicker.
Right, and, you know, there were a couple games last year. I know Robbie didn't miss a lot of field goals last year, but it was when he missed them, and they were game-affecting misses. So that's the problem. He's 34 years old. The leg isn't what it used to be. Extremely accurate in years past, but now less and less. He can't kick it as far, and I think they're just trying to go in a new direction.
Well, and what else? What else was it? Parnell McPhee goes on the PUP list.
You know what that means?
The physically unable to play.
No, do you know what that means, though? He can't play for the first six weeks.
Games, right. So he's done.
Well,
for 6 weeks,
in.
Yeah,
right,
but
yeah.
He's out, so there's no question that he is really hurt. What do we know about Kyle Long? He nagging little things throughout the throughout training camp and now the preseason, but he's back in practice, right?
There was this worry that he had a torn labrum. I think that has been dismissed, but it's in that shoulder area, and as you know, as you imagine, when you block, run block or pass block, your hands and your arms are extremely important. So even if it isn't torn, if it's tweaked, if it's strained, that opens up the door for something down the road. But Kyle Long is so tough and so physical, and he's going to play. I mean, if he had a cast on or a club on, he would play. So I'm not surprised that he's going to give it a go on Sunday against Houston. J.J. Watt, by the way, the best player for the Texans.
I just heard.
He is playing. So Charles Leno, your left tackle, look out. Although Watt pretty much lines up anywhere. So it should be an interesting one on Sunday. It's finally here. No more preseason, no more practice, no more training camp, no more of that. Let's get to the real deal on Sunday.
What do you make of, you know, obviously, like you said, Stinton falls into their lap. You got to take him. But they drafted a guard. Whitehair, is that the guy?
Cody Whitehair from Kansas State.
So what happens to him now? Obviously, you know, give him a little more time to develop, which can't be bad. But does that break a guy's spirit?
Adam Hoge tweeted today that John Fox, the Bears head coach, said today publicly that Cody Whitehair's best position is center.
Oh.
So read the tea leaves there, Brian.
Hey, well, I guess we know what's happening
because
there.
Because Ronis Grassou, their starting center, is out, injured for the season, injured reserve. So that was the domino that fell. And then, of course, in the offseason, they cut Matt Slauson.
Right.
So there were some puzzle pieces missing. But now you signed Sitton from Green Bay. They cut him. Bears bring him in. And you've got Whitehair at center. You've got Long right guard, left tackle Leno, right tackle Bobby Massey. So the line is looking pretty solid, and that's what you need from a Bears football team that's going to look to run the ball a lot.
Is that because the Bears are a little shaky with their confidence
in their quarterback and receivers?
Head,
he's a head coach that loves to run the football.
Yeah.
And everything opens up when you can run it. It makes the receiving lanes better. It opens up play action. They're going to throw some deep shots to Jeffrey and White. But this defense is going to be the key to the team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they can keep guys out of the end zone, the Bears will be in a lot of football games. Now, in the NFL, as you know, talent's everything.
Right.
You can be close. It's cute to be close, but you got to win in the fourth quarter. They didn't do it last year. That's why they were 6-10. They'd like to win more this year.
What do you think? If you were in the predicting game.
Which I am. I think 8-8.
Is that right?
I think 8-8. That
seems optimistic.
That's, well, it's a 2-win increase from last year. Okay. Now, you look at the jumps that Fox's team made in Carolina mm-hmm. and in Denver from years one to two, a lot more wins in that second season. I just don't think the Bears have enough talent on both sides of the ball. They're getting better. They're rebuilding. This regime is trying to restack this right. tree. And I think they're doing a good job. And you can tell right now by the cutting of Robbie Gould, they mean business.
The secondary, though, is still – it was a question last year. It's a question again this year. Why can't the Bears – find good people for the secondary?
I don't have an answer for you there.
Well, listen,
I
asked
did.
The question.
I
you
wish
need to
I
get,
did.
Yeah, should, they wish they did.
Well, drafting is going to be huge. I mean, they've got a guy at safety, Adrian Amos, they like. The last regime drafted Kyle Fuller. They're still believing in him. There's a couple pieces that will come in and out, but maybe there are some options in the offseason next year. Remember, this is Ryan Pace isn't viewing this as boom or bust for 16.
Right.
He's viewing this as a five-year plan. You know, okay. So he's looking at pieces that he could possibly get in the offseason. Trades are always possible. The Broncos have made Aqib Talib available. Supposedly he's a Pro Bowler, a cornerback. There's a lot of moves to be made, and I do actually trust Ryan Pace here.
Jay Cutler, now the longest tenured Chicago Bear.
He's the oldest Bear.
He's the oldest Bear. He is the future of the franchise. Still.
Sure.
I don't get it, but...
My joke is... when the Bears finally get good, he's still going to throw a pick in a big moment in a big game. So,
sure, that's his thing.
Because that's what he does.
That's his trademark. That's how it works.
Throw the ball to your own team.
Yeah, that's a lot of hassle. Finding the same
color
uniform.
The other way.
Yeah,
it's more fun the other way.
Throw it and make your guys just try to find it. Throw it up in the air. All right, Sam Panayotovich is here. He's here all day. We'll talk to him some more. We'll talk a lot of things. But now we must talk about the roads because Laura Vaughn has been peering into her crystal ball trying to figure out where the traffic trouble spots are. We'll be talking to Mark Sapelsa after 6 o'clock because that's what they do here on the Rokan Show with Anna DeVlantes. I'm Brian Noonan, and I like doing the same thing. We were talking with the CPS earlier with Janice Jackson, the chief education officer of the Chicago Public Schools. I saw this story. It's an opinion piece, but I think it makes a lot of sense. It says if sex education is required in schools, why shouldn't financial education be required in schools? And I think that's a wonderful idea. Here's the thing. Sex ed became mainstream. Financial education is not. The result is that U.S. ranks 14th behind Israel, Canada, Australia, Singapore, and much of Europe in financial literacy. They say rich kids learn about money at home. Middle class and kids from less financially secure families, they don't talk about money at home, so they never really learn about it. All those numbers are coming from a huge survey, 150,000 people in 148 countries, conducted by Standard & Poor's. So Americans are stuck. Let me see if you can answer this simple financial question. Joey Gelman, who I'm guessing will
goodness.
Be able to answer this because you conned me out of $15 earlier, so I know. All right, suppose you need to borrow $100. Which is the lower amount to pay back, $105 or $100 plus 3%?
Everyone's been asking me to do too much math today. Bertrand earlier and
3%.
Then in the newsroom. So
Because it's 100. It's an easy math.
Right. So it would be the 100 plus 3% because that 3% of 100 is $3, so $103.
Oh, that makes sense.
Less, of course it does.
I got to think it through.
Well, sure you did.
If but you had 3 hours, I'm good to go.
No, you wanted to go on some big rant about why, Bertrand asked me to do it. You were stalling. I like
Absolutely.
That. Absolutely. But most Americans, like you, were stumped by that. Americans, according to this, have serious money issues. Nearly half the people in this country say they don't have enough money saved to cover even a $400 emergency expense. And a third of Americans regularly carry credit card debt with an average balance of a whopping $15,000. That's according to data from the Federal Reserve and NerdWallet. So, this writer, this CNF financial analyst, said we need to start teaching this in school. Not just a couple classes maybe in high school, but from kindergarten on, teaching people about saving money, teaching people about investing, teaching people to be financially responsible. Because once you get to a certain age, you get out, you get out of high school, then you're deciding, or while you're in high school, you decide, okay, am I going to take on college debt? The average debt load from college debt now $29,000. So you've decided to take that on. Then you get out into the world, you start a job, you got to choose your health care provider, you got to choose different insurance plans, you have to decide how much and when you're going to start saving for retirement because they say you need $1 million to retire securely. Yeah, good luck. I'm going to work till I'm going to work as they're putting me in the hole. I'm still going to be working because there's no chance. $1 million. The typical American family, they say, has just over $100,000 saved for retirement by their early 60s. So the argument is, if we're going to teach sex ed, which has been very effective in cutting down teen pregnancy rates and other things, why not teach financial education to help get America out of the financial troubles that we're in? And I know those kind of all programs like that cost money, but I think it's something we need to, and I'm not trying to make a pun, we need to invest in that kind of thing.
Why would that cost any more than just math?
Probably not. Just to, you know, to add books in a curriculum costs some money. You know, train some teachers to do that kind of thing. There's a cost. Anytime you implement something new, there's a cost to it. But it's one of those things. I mean, I love my parents. We never talked about money at home. You know, we learned I have four brothers. So out of the five of us, I'm probably the worst with money. I'm probably more like my mom and dad. My other brothers have gone the other way, which is good. So it's one of those things. And I have other friends of mine whose parents also never talked to them about money. And some are in good shape. Some are in okay shape. There's none that are really in horrible, horrible shape. But everybody's, you know, at their own different level. And I think that's one of those things where if you're learning it in school and you can go home and then have that conversation at the house, it works out that much better. So something to think about as we move forward and think about the future of education for our kids.
There's never that life planning class, and that's what I've always looked for. It's that idea of, sure, you can take math or you can take econ in school, but it's not offered in a way that would be, here's the applicable math you need or the applicable guideline to start a life after high school, after college.
This is
offered.
When you should start saving. This is how much you should save. This is where you should put your money.
Because as you can see, I can't do math very well per the last quiz you just gave me.
And that was an easy one. As bad as I am at math, I knew that answer.
But it just, you know, maybe if you're not that skilled at math, that's okay. But there's never that track of going, okay, here's how you would invest in this thing. Here's what you need to save for insurance. This is how much you cost to cable even. And anything you need to prepare for, it's not really laid out for you early.
Right. All right. News in less than a minute on WGN. Brian Noonan on 720 WGN in for Ro Khan and Anna DeVellantes. Ro and Anna will be back tomorrow after they enjoy their Labor Day holiday. We all can remember, we might not remember the exact date, April 20th, 1999, but all you have to say is the word Columbine and you remember exactly what happened. You remember what you were doing and you remember watching the news coverage. A man who will never forget what happened that day because he was the first SWAT officer through the doors in Columbine is Grant Wittes. He is a 26-year veteran of the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office, served 17 years on SWAT, the last seven as a SWAT team leader. He has a brand new book out, Bullet Riddled, The First SWAT Officer Inside Columbine and Beyond, and he joins me now on WGN. Grant, thanks for taking some time. Congratulations on the new book.
Well, thank you, Brian. I appreciate you having me.
So why wait this long to tell the story? We know Columbine happened so long ago. Did you have to wait until you retired? Was there some sort of statute of limitations on when you could talk about things?
Well, great question. I wanted to write it about 07 after the Platte Canyon school shooting happened. And then I was warned by the bosses at the work that you're responsible for everything that goes into that book and everything you say. And if we don't like it, you're going to pay for it. So I decided to wait till I retired. And then that was my first venture after I retired. So that's why, believe me, I wanted to tell the story long ago.
Well, it's a fascinating story. And you mentioned Platte Canyon as well, because that's another big operation that you were involved in. But most of us on the national level, we know about Columbine. And what I liked about the book is, and you alluded to this when your bosses told you, you know, if we don't like what you're saying, there's some parts of the book where you're critical of what happened not only that day but on other operations. And it's a book that when you're reading, or when I was reading it anyway, I could tell it was really in your voice. It didn't it wasn't, you know, polished up where you could say, oh, this guy is trying to cover something up. It seemed very, very honest to me.
Well, thank you, Brian. I'm glad you read it and like it. You know, I did. I wrote it, and I wrote it about with my failures in there. You know, my first mass shooting, how I failed that, and then we got to Columbine. We had conflict inside of Columbine, even working. And I tried to be honest as I could about the good and the bad because, you know, every time you read something, you say, they say it went great. It didn't. You know, there was always something that could have been improved on. So many things we learned from Columbine and that we pushed into the future. And I've trained thousands of law enforcement officers across the United States now on how to respond to these mass shootings. So there was a lot of good that came from it. And, of course, by the time we got to the Black Canyon school shooting, you know, unfortunately, we became very good at them.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to that morning, April 20th, 1999. You had the day off, correct?
I did. I was at home that day with my son.
And so how do you get the call and take us up to the point where you arrive at the high school?
Sure. So day off that day, back then we all had phones, and as soon as a SWAT call out came, you know, your phone would tell you to call in. I called in. They told me there was a shooting at Platte Canyon, or I'm sorry, Columbine High School, and I said, at Columbine, I couldn't believe it. It was the nicest school in our entire jurisdiction. And so we drove in, got in the SWAT van. Basically, I was running late, so they left. I got in the car, met them down there, just got tacked up right there, and off we went. We went right to the back of the school, met up with some Denver SWAT officers that were already there. Basically, the Denver officer said that was the last place we saw him was a cafeteria, and off we went immediately. He broke the window, and I jumped through the window.
So you enter the school, and you're the lead shield officer. So does that mean you're carrying the plexiglass shield? What does that terminology mean?
Yeah, it's actually a ballistic shield. It has kind of a window. You can see through it. And it'll stop some small arms fire. It won't stop rifle fire, but, you know, by the time it hits the shield and then your vest, it has a pretty good chance of stopping. So I always go in first, and I fully believe by the time my feet hit the ground and what we saw and what we heard, we thought at that time we were fighting 9 different shooters inside the school from all the information that was coming in, that I'd be in the firefight the minute I entered that. And, you know, obviously I wasn't. We got in and then started finding, as we went room to room looking for them, hundreds and hundreds of children in rooms, and it took forever to get them out. And then, you know, as you read on, I took care of the teacher up there until he passed away. And then we moved right over to the library, not knowing, you know, the majority of it happened in the library. And there I found the 2 shooters.
And thankfully, most of us are never going to have to encounter a scene like you and your team did that day. You go into the library, you said, and it's a very tense read, this the beginning of this chapter. You're coming up, you see in the windows of the library, you see a big black bag in the middle of the floor, so you assume, rightfully so, that it's a homemade bomb. And then when you enter, you couldn't really see everything, but what you did see was horrifying.
Absolutely. You know, as we got close to it, you could start seeing there was a lot of bodies down. And, of course, we heard there were so many bombs, and there were so many smaller bombs that went off. We fully believed that if we didn't get the children out immediately, that, you know, a bomb was going to drop the place. So, anyway, make an entry into that library. As you read in the book, that, you know, there was a young girl that survived with several gunshots. As I turned left going into that library, and I had to step right over her, knowing that I found the place the shooters were at, and that we were about to be involved in a gun battle right there. And of course, I found them dead. But the rest of the library was just a horrific scene. I hope nobody experiences that in their life. But and then the aftermath of what it did to the SWAT team was just incredible, and how we kind of fell apart after that.
Well, that's what I want to get into, because the recriminations from that were unbelievable to some extent. But let me go back just 1 minute, because police officers would understand this, and I think most readers will understand it. But you point out how on the surface, it might seem heartless. This girl who was wounded, she reached up to you for help, and you told her, "I can't stop." And in the book, you say, "I know that seems heartless, but obviously, like I said, in a tactical situation, other police officers would realize that's what you have to do, right?"
Oh, absolutely. You know, when you enter a scene and you find someone down, but you know that's the shooting scene, the first thing you have to do is take the shooters out and then render aid. So we knew that I knew I had to do that going through there. And absolutely stepping over her has just ripped my heart out. But, you know, fortunately she lived through it, and then the 2 shooters were dead. So, yeah, it was an awful thing. And to this day, she's never spoken of it. She's stayed quiet this entire time.
Speaking of staying quiet, that was one of the things that led to some of the problems with the team in the aftermath of Columbine. You and the rest of the SWAT team decided, you know what, we're not going to talk about this. We're going to keep it to ourselves. And then the press coverage and everything else, you guys were not always painted in the most flattering light.
No, you're right. We found, you know, we wanted to, for the family's sake, keep quiet on everything that we saw in there. So we made an agreement amongst ourselves that we wouldn't talk about this. And then as days went, we found that if we don't talk, there's always someone willing to fill in those blanks for us, and those blanks weren't accurate. So, you know, they were pretty soon we were being called cowards and how we did nothing, and no one had any idea what we really did. And then so by the time we got to Platte Canyon, we realized we had to talk the minute it was over. So no one's there filling in the blanks with inaccurate information again, selling us in a bad light.
Didn't any of your supervisors step up during any of this and say, listen, these reports are inaccurate. Here's what our team did, and it went this way. And I don't understand the label of cowards for you guys.
You know, they didn't back then. I mean, if you look at it, realistically, this was the first, certainly wasn't the first mass murder in America, but mm-hmm. it was the first one that the media could actually hit. They have the technology to cover as it's going.
Yeah.
And they never stopped from the time we were there afterwards, the next day, and the coverage never ended. So, you know, it was unique in that fact that we wouldn't talk, and then so many people would talk about what we should have done, what we could have done, and that had no idea because they weren't even there. So no one talked, and our bosses didn't talk. I thought they felt the same thing. Maybe we shouldn't say anything, and we'll let this information come out, you know, organically, basically through the reports, and then it turned into a lawsuit. So certainly we weren't talking after that.
So would you say, you mentioned in the book there were some mistakes made during that operation. Would that be at the top of the list?
No, yeah, absolutely. I mean, what we did and the mistakes that were made, and we realized immediately, was we patrol could no longer wait for SWAT to get there. It took us over an hour to arrive.
Oh, geez.
And back then in 99, the police were taught surround it, wait for SWAT, and they'll go in. Since then, we taught the first patrolman to get through that door and engage that shooter. He either gives up or is killed. There's no in-between, and there's no negotiation. So get through that door. And now today we teach one- and two-man response to the active shooter.
So that was the biggest thing, the response time. And what else did you learn? Because you mentioned things were learned at Columbine that then went on to help in all these other shootings like Platte Canyon and others.
Well, we realized then we had to be so aggressive. And we were, us in Denver, we kind of divided up and broke into two different teams inside the school. In hindsight, we should have had every SWAT team that was there sending teams in there. So we had 8 to 10, 12 teams going in there to find the shooters right away because, again, the information, we had 7 to 9 shooters, and then they didn't go in. We were going to take care of it ourselves. We thought the minute we got in there, we'd be in that shooting. Now, in today's world, we would send teams, you know, 2 4-man teams in there, one right after another until we encountered the shooters and ended as quick as possible. That was the biggest thing that we learned. And like I said, it moved over to the patrolman now, and it's now their responsibility, not SWAT's responsibility, to take them out.
When a SWAT team goes through an operation like this and sees the carnage that you guys saw, obviously there was an effect because of the poor reporting from the press and the stuff that was out in the public. But emotionally, how do guys on the team deal with something like that?
Well, as you read the book, you know, we didn't do well with it the first time. I had some conflicts with my partner inside there. And then a few days later, we almost get in a fist fight. We both get suspended for it. And then, you know, back then, they didn't have a lot of psychological help for us. Basically, we got done with it, talked to the psychs for a few minutes, and that was it. And the SWAT guys are never going to talk to the psychs unless they're mandated to. So right. It ended, but it got worse. The team divided. I took over the young side of it. There was an old side. They kind of shut down. I said to them, you know, another one's going to happen, and we're going to train for it. So the team got divided right down the middle, the old and the young, and it just tore the team apart. So about a year, year and a half later, I took over the team. All the old ones left, and then I rebuilt it with all young athletes.
And this is that's a different sort of mentality being on a SWAT team than being it takes a unique mentality to be a police officer, and then there's a different mindset to be a SWAT team member, correct?
Oh, there is. I you know, I recruited them from the time they hit the academy. I would see great athletes that were very smart, and I would tell them, when you have enough time in, you come test for SWAT. So I was wise in how I picked them. And then I had several departments to pick from because we were a regional team. So I picked the greatest, smartest athletes I could from every police department around me and sheriff's office. And then I built what I considered the ultimate team going into the Platte Canyon school shooting.
Now, you mentioned Platte Canyon, and outside of Colorado, that one is not quite as well known as Columbine. It didn't get quite the coverage. What was the main difference in how you and the team handled the shooter situation there?
Yeah, like you said, it's not a well-known one, but in the book, if you read it, it's by far the most intense story that people tell me they've ever read, because it's true. This 50-year-old man walks into Platte Canyon School, starts shooting off rounds, takes girls hostages in one of the school rooms, kicks the teachers and all the males out, sexually assaults a few of them, and then releases them. So by the time we get up there, there's three in the room, and ultimately lets one go, and then he hides between the other two. What made that one so unique is he was in the back of that room hiding behind him, and we could barely see him. We're using a mirror to see him, and then he says, I got explosive, and this whole thing is going to be over at 4 o'clock. So, and he would not negotiate. So we knew and we believed at 4 o'clock we had to have something done,
right,
or that place was going to blow up, or he was going to kill both children right there. So by that time, we'd become pretty good at it. We were using explosives to blow out walls and doors to get to people like that and shoot them as quick as possible.
Well, the whole way that SWAT all over the country has reacted to these horrible incidents has changed, all based on Columbine. If you want to read a fascinating book and a firsthand account of what went on, not only at Columbine but at Platte Canyon and a number of other places, and a very honest book, as you mentioned earlier, Grant, you talked about your first big mistake at the Albertsons, and it was. It's a heartbreaking read. It's an exciting read. The book is Bullet Riddled, The First SWAT Officer Inside Columbine and Beyond. Grant Wittes is the man behind that badge, behind the shield. And, Grant, I appreciate your time this afternoon. Good luck with the book.
Ryan, thank you so much for having me.
Take care. That's Grant Wittes. Pick it up. Bullet Riddled, The First SWAT Officer Inside Columbine and Beyond. You're going to wish you were in some sort of armored truck to drive over the horrible traffic. But that's why we have Laura Vaughn to tell you how to avoid it and the traffic troubles. All right, after the news, Mark Sapelsa will join us. We'll talk about what's coming up on WGN and talk a little bit to Mark about who knows what. Well, you'll find out. You have to be here after the news. I have been the recipient in my younger days of the anger of women that I have wronged, ex-girlfriends, etc. But you leave it to someone in Florida to take it to the extreme. Carmen Chambly, 19, was arrested after she attempted to get revenge on her ex-boyfriend by setting fire to his car. I go to the lovely women upstairs. Have you ever done anything that drastic when you were young and impetuous? Kim, you ever set anybody's car on fire? Tarred their house?
No.
Shaved their head while they slept?
I will confess, I did egg a house when I was in high school. I told you I wasn't perfect.
No, listen, I'm glad to see you're not perfect. If you were, you'd scare me. So was this boyfriend related or just prank related?
Prank related.
Ah, all right. Yeah, I never did that. I was always too scared to do that.
A teacher we didn't like so much.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that wasn't very good, was it?
Oh, man. Well, I think the statute of limitations has probably expired.
I think the teacher expired, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that'll stop that, too. Laura, you ever do anything impulsive like that?
I can't think of anything.
No.
Sorry.
I think so. No, don't be sorry. That's good. Because, let's be honest, we all hope, no matter who we're dating, that if that relationship ends, they're not going to go completely psycho on us. And yet, sometimes they do. I had a girl throw a brick at me in my parents' backyard. A brick.
Did she hit you?
Well, see how I talk and
so
think
that's
now.
That's what's wrong.
That's exactly what's wrong. She had pretty good aim. She's a softball player. No, she did hit me in the mid-range, my stomach, chest area.
I think I know what she was aiming for.
Probably. Either that or if she wanted more accuracy, she could have gone with half a brick, but she went with an entire brick. And I don't know why we had bricks just in the backyard. It wasn't like I grew up in a foundry. But anyway, this woman, Carmen Chambly, she set the car on fire. Best laid plans of mice and men often go awry, according to the article. There was one major hurdle in her plot to achieve fiery retribution. That's right, she burned the wrong car. I have no idea who she is, the car owner, Thomas Jennings, told the local TV station. He exited his residence at the urging of his alarmed roommate, only to see the giant blaze that was once his Honda. I've never seen her in my life, he said. Chablis allegedly stuck a rag in the car's gas tank and set it on fire. She may have also used a flammable liquid to bring further misdirected fury to the forsaken four-door. And the other good part about this, it was all caught on security camera. So, lovely. All right, if you're going to burn a car, make sure it's the right car. That's all you learned from this show, how to burn the correct car. News in a minute on WGN. It's Brian Noonan in for Ro Khan and Anna DeVellantes. And as they do every night, and I do when I'm here at 6 o'clock, we say hello to WGN-TV's own Mark Sapelsa. Hi, Mark. How are you?
Mr. Noonan, how are you?
I am dandy. Did you have a good holiday up to this point?
This is truly Labor Day for me. My first day back after 3 weeks off with the family on a big vacation.
Wow.
So I'm laboring today because I haven't been for the last 3 weeks.
I was going to say, do you forget how to do the news after 3 weeks?
I are a broadcaster who does not know how to read very well. Yes, I was practicing immensely today just to kind of get back in this way.
Can you tell us where you went, or is it a state secret?
No, yeah. So my son is kind of a world traveler. He goes to school in England, but he had a scholarship, kind of an abroad year in Japan. So he studied for a year in Japan, learning the language, learning the politics, because he's into international politics and world affairs. So it was the end of his school year, basically, the beginning of August. We went there to meet him and kind of see his campus and see what he's been going through for the year. And then we traveled Japan with him because he knows the language and the train system. It was truly a remarkable family experience, but watching him navigate what is an incredible maze, an amazing train system, but it is complicated. And he did it like there was no tomorrow, and he made it so much easier on us. It was unbelievable.
Wow. What was the biggest – had you been to Japan before?
Never. Never in my life. No.
So what was the biggest thing that hit you that made an impression?
It is the most polite society in the world, I believe. You buy a gum pack from a convenience store. Literally, they have 7-Elevens just like we do, only they're probably a little more gussied up with food and things like that. You buy a pack of gum, and they bow to you.
Oh, wow.
You buy a train ticket or ask for directions, and they literally act like you're the king of England, the queen of England, the president. It's unbelievable. It's almost too much because you feel like you need to reciprocate, but it is a wonderful experience. Sometimes you'll get so-so service at a fast food place.
Sure.
Or what do you want? Or, I'd like a latte, please. Really? Okay, hang on a second. None of that there. It's unbelievable. That's the first thing that really strikes you is the incredible politeness of everybody at every time, all occasions, doesn't matter what it is, flight attendants, hotels, or on the street. They're awfully polite every moment of their lives.
And the one thing, as I see pictures and video, anything coming from Japan, it's mostly from Tokyo, and I see how crowded it is. Is the rest of the country that crowded, or once you leave the city, does it open up more?
It's amazing. It is crowded in certain sections of Tokyo, but what makes it, and the answer to your overall question is no, it's not nearly as crowded as the city of Tokyo. However, there are sections of Tokyo. There are a couple of famous intersections where people take, we took video and pictures because it's like almost like the six-way, intersection of Milwaukee and whatever, Damon there, where you've got six stoplights. And when it all turns red and pedestrians can walk, you can go any direction. So it looks like swarm of people. You're right in the middle of Times Square type thing. But there's only a few of those. And what is remarkable, Brian, is the train system is so vast, so incredible, so efficient, so on time, and so many of them that there's no traffic jams.
Really?
No traffic jams. I mean, you might have,
sure,
5 o'clock rush hour to a certain degree, but I'm telling you, I saw the busiest streets or highways of Tokyo at peak time, and nobody was stopped.
That's amazing.
All traffic, because most people take the trains because they're so incredible. You stand on a track waiting for a commuter train to take you, let's say, three stops down, which would be the equivalent of a quarter mile or a mile, and two tracks over is a 250-mile-an-hour bullet train blowing by. Ooh. So in one station, everywhere, are all these trains, the fast, the medium, and the not so, you know, not
yeah, just
that
the regular,
so,
yeah.
Just the regular, and they're all on time. And they're all clean. There's no graffiti. They've got cloth seats. You could eat off the floor. It's truly remarkable. That, though, makes Tokyo a very efficient city. You got 34 million people, but you've got wonderful neighborhoods where you feel like you could hear the birds and no cars because the trains are running and there aren't that many cars in the city. So it's really a remarkable place.
That is amazing. And as your son moved there for a year, and I know you said the people were very polite if you're in a store or things like that. How hard is it to acclimate to living there? Are they accepting of foreign people emigrating to their city?
It's a good question because I think as he described it, it is very insular. They're very proud of their heritage, mm-hmm. no question about it, just like all
sure.
nations are. So I think it is difficult at times to sort of crack that code, so to speak, that social code.
Mm-hmm.
They are very polite, but I did notice a demeanor of, let's say, the working people on the commuter trains or marching to the commuter trains for work or even, heading to a store. There is a somber look about them. And I said to my son, yeah, no, nobody really is smiling at you type thing. And he said, well, that's kind of a politeness thing. That's a cultural thing. If somebody's smiling at you in Japan, there's something a little awkward about that or something a little bit like, yeah, that's a little freaky. Why is that guy smiling? Unlike Americans that are like, hey, how's it going? How's
right.
your day? Hey, high five. You know, there's none of that. It's just kind of a very buttoned up type society. So I think allowing foreigners in, I think they're very polite, but when my son learned Japanese, he could hear some utterances behind his back of people saying, oh, foreigner, blah, 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 that type of thing.
Yeah.
So I think just like any other society, we all, you know, squawk and moan a little bit about, somebody that drives the wrong way down
sure.
the street because they haven't been here that long or whatever. Same thing's going to happen there, but I think for the most part, though, they're a very, very accepting people in terms of, you know, hey, you're visiting or you're staying for a year. That's wonderful. However, you're still not part of us,
right.
so to speak.
We'll let you stay here and do your business,
yeah,
but
exactly.
you know, you're not coming over for dinner.
Right. Right.
Well, that makes sense. Look, your kids are just going gangbusters, and I don't mean to embarrass you, but I know there's only a few days left. I have to congratulate you on your daughter's song about
you,
which was wonderful, and I have voted for her, hopefully.
You are so kind to do
help.
So.
And if people don't know, your daughter Ava is an aspiring songwriter and wrote
right.
a wonderful song about a very tough subject.
Absolutely, right. She I didn't know she was writing this a couple of years ago that she wrote it, maybe a year and a half ago. No, maybe a little less than that. Maybe my clock is running too fast, but it might have been last year, I think. Yeah, last year. And she said, Dad, I wrote a song about you. And it was about my battle with alcoholism. And I'm almost 5 years in recovery now, about four and a half. And she said, I want you to hear this. And, you know, it took me to my knees. I was broken up over it. Tears of joy, but also just, you know, what an amazing thought process from a 19-year-old
yeah.
who had to live through, you know, her dad going to treatment, which, you know, can be an embarrassing subject or it can be a terrible subject. She handled it with grace, and she wrote a song about it. Then there was this songwriting contest that came up, so she entered the song, and she's in the lead. And I say in large part due to the fact of the quality of the song, and
yeah.
sure, we've all tried to help her out with Facebook and everything else, but I'm so proud of her and so proud of how she handled my situation and how she's handling it, you know, in public too.
No, it's a great song, and it shows a remarkable level of maturity, because a lot of people, as you say, you're going to handle something like that different. Everybody's going to handle it differently, and some are going to step up and handle it in a very productive way, which your daughter has.
That's, and thank you so much for saying that. And I said to them over this holiday or this vacation time that we were all together, you know, my son's 21, daughter's 19, we've got two kids, and I said, you know, you guys are more mature than I ever was and ever will be. They handle things, you know, I can't tell you how many times I get the old, Dad, you know, one of those deals.
Yeah.
Every parent does, but they are just that much more mature than I was and ever will be, and very proud of them.
Well, congratulations. You should be. All right, let's turn to the news. I know, sure. I know you've been away for a while, but I also know that you're keeping your ear to the ground.
Yep. Best I can.
Despite the fact that we still had a couple, few murders and some shootings this weekend, overall down from last year, still cause for concern, which had Eddie Johnson out on the streets this weekend. Do you think that had an effect, having the superintendent out on patrol?
It is a really good question. Sometimes I feel like it has no impact. In other words, sometimes, and again, I'm not a gangbanger. I'm not, you know, holed up with them. I'm not, you know, watching it 24/7 like they are, like the police officers and the forces that reckon with them are. But, you know, sometimes I feel like gangbangers don't care. You know,
yeah.
Shootings happen because of the way they work their drug trade and the way neighborhoods are now constructed, unfortunately, or the way, you know, violence occurs through passion or through anger. But, you know, maybe there is something to the fact that if the police chief is on the streets, maybe there is a better system of organization that is returning to the streets of Chicago, to the city of Chicago, to the police department. Because when when Superintendent McCarthy was let go, and then there was that lull as to, you know, who's going to be the soup, you know, and all the shootings that have occurred, including Laquan McDonald, you have had a shakeup within the rank and file. So maybe there's some organization returning that perhaps we lost there for a number of months. It's just one weekend. It's just, you know, 3, 4, 5 days where you can count this Labor Day being less violent than the last couple. Who knows what will happen next weekend? Who knows what will happen next month? So I hate to put a stake in and say, well, nice job, Soup. You know, you got on the streets and numbers are down. Maybe it's just coincidence. We really don't know.
Right. But at least I think from a PR standpoint, from the optics of it, look good that he's backing up what he's saying, that we're going to make some changes and we're going to be hands on. And they, you know, they made sure they got rid of a lot of the guys involved with the Laquan McDonald case. And now their news comes out today that two cops were fired, face firing again after a videotape beating a couple years ago. So it's starting to at least look better from the outside.
It's complicated, though, because, you know, as the police board and the superintendent make these moves, and the public in general might say, you know, hip, hip, hooray for, you know, eradicating bad police officers or police officers who made a some terrible mistakes. You wonder what's happening within the rank and file.
Right.
You know, so that knife can cut both ways. And so it's difficult to say how it will play out. But no question about it, I think what the superintendent is doing is what appears to be the correct either political or optic thing to do with the public, which is take action when something seems to not be right to the average eye. And if the police board and the superintendent can concur that it is not correct, what the public sees was actually not correct,
right,
and you take action, then maybe the public says, hey, they are doing their jobs.
What are you guys working on for the big broadcasts tonight?
You know, we're following the Clinton-Trump campaign, which one of them cut through the state of Illinois. Right now, speaking in the Quad Cities is Hillary Clinton.
Is anybody sending her a lozenge? She really is having some problems.
Did you see
today.
That? It was like a 3-minute coughing jag. Yeah.
I was like, this poor woman, somebody go up and get her a tea or something.
I feel like she hasn't been right all summer in terms of the voice. I mean, I remember in July, she was raspy. At the convention, she was raspy. And, you know, she was clearing her throat some 13 times in the first, you know, 40 minutes of her, you know, DNC convention speech. She needs a big, long rest, but unfortunately, that's not going to come.
Not going to happen. So we're covering the campaigns,
yep,
and that's the big story, and I'm sure back to school will be in there and everything else. Welcome back. We're glad to have you back in the U.S. and back on WGN. Mark, always good to talk to you.
Mr. Noonan, thank you very much.
Enjoy the rest of your holiday. We'll talk soon. Bye-bye. That's Mark Sapalsa. He talks to Rowan Anna every day at 6 o'clock when he's not jetting around to foreign lands. We're glad to have him back. Somebody who has not been jetting. She has been stuck in her chair looking at those traffic screens thinking, oh, no, there's so many trouble spots. Here's Laura Vaughn. I'm going to have to watch this Sunday because I am horrible at any sort of home improvement. I have neither the know-how nor the patience to get things done. And today, my hose valve, you know, on the outside of the house where you turn the hose on, the handle was just spinning. So I tried to tighten it down, and that didn't work. So I was able to get the little red handle part off. I'm hoping that that's all it needs. I'm going to go to a trusty hardware store tomorrow. Not one of those big bar, but a trusty little local one, and go, all right. Because I'm thinking, if I have to take the valve off or something, forget about it. Then I'm done. Then the water is shut off at the house for 6 months, and also that the flowers will stay alive. At some point, you gotta let the flowers go. That's all. All right. On the other side of the news, oh my goodness, a Mississippi school is punishing a 9-year-old girl. Why? You won't believe it. We'll talk about that after the news on WGN. Now we just danced for the last 25 minutes of the big broadcast, and then we go on about our merry Labor Day way. It's Brian Noonan in for Ro Khan and Anna DeVlantes. Ro and Anna back, of course, tomorrow when the holiday is over. It's always a pleasure to sit in for them when they are out, when one or both of them are out. Mark Carman, I hear, is coming up at 7 o'clock. Is that correct, Joey? Mark Carman sitting in for Justin Kaufman.
That's what it looks like on the big mean schedule.
Well, we'll see if that schedule bears fruit or if it's just another ruse to confuse us and make us look like we can't read English. Well, we know you can't do math.
Very true.
We know I am limited at math. We know Kim has admitted that she is borderline with her math prowess, and the rest of the newsroom
almost
is
bad. That's kind. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. I don't want to throw you, you know, completely under the bus. I'll just let it run over your toes.
You can throw me under the calculator.
There you go. It was, and you know what? My daughter, who is a very good student, also struggles in math. I don't know what it is. Some people, I think we're just wired different ways. Some people are wired for math and that kind of thing, and other people are not. Somebody texted in when we were talking about this before that psychologists said that people who are good at math make good life choices. Which,
uh-oh,
if that's true, that would explain a lot. Because my lack of math skills and my life choices, if you put them next to each other, you go, oh, there is a correlation there.
But see, I can do language. I just can't do math. Like, sometimes the right one side of the brain works for language, others math.
That's how it is. I don't know. I think my brain is just kind of there. Sometimes it works.
Just
sometimes
around.
It doesn't. Yeah, it helps. I'm worried about language. I'm trying to pick up some essential Spanish phrases in advance of my trip to España. So far, not much. But I have other things that I'm worried about first, so then I'll learn from there. You know what I'm worried about? I'm worried about 9-year-old girls who are being fat-shamed at school. We hear a lot about that now. Everything is shaming. There's fat-shaming. There's this shaming. There's that shaming. And I also have never been a fan, and I've talked about this in any number of cases, of zero tolerance policies when it comes to school. I think you have to have rules and you have to enforce rules, but every once in a while something will come along and you have to look at the individual case and say, okay, this doesn't really fit the criteria for what the punishment should be. So a school in Mississippi, and this is great because school has just started. And we are going to be inundated with dress code violations and dress code problems from now until June, probably. And then it'll take a month or so break and we'll start up again. Because every school now is trying to police what kids wear to school. And I've got to be honest, I think it would all be so much easier if public schools just went to uniforms. I see it in the district I'm in. When they get to high school and middle school and high school, the kids just wear uniforms. It's a blue polo shirt and some khakis, and you can get them. I've seen them everywhere, from, you know, rather pricey to very inexpensive at Walmart and other stores where you can get uniform clothes for reasonable prices. And I think that would end all of these stories, and we wouldn't have to deal with any more of these dress code violations and these dress code things. So just put the kids in uniform and send them on their merry way. Because then, you know what? Kids aren't looking at each other, trying to compare what they're wearing. To me, it seems so much simpler. All right, Brookhaven, Mississippi is the dateline for this. Educators are being slammed for body shaming a 9-year-old girl that they yanked out of class for wearing clothes that they considered to be too tight. Now, not too revealing. It wasn't. I have the pictures here. And this young girl, has a little bit of a weight problem. And I don't say that. Hi, Don. How are you, buddy? Good to see you. That's all right. Don's in. He was checking out his mic. And it's always, I haven't seen Don Norton in a long time. Always comes dressed in a tie. The man is the most professional broadcaster in the room today. I'm barely wearing pants and Don comes in a suit. I like that. I like that from my news people. All right. So anyway, the young girl is a little overweight. And I don't say that as a slam. I'm just setting it up for the story because it's very important to the story. So the young girl is a little bit overweight. And we've all seen young kids who are a little chunky or pudgy, whatever you want to use for your adjective. You know, they're not the ideal weight. They may grow out of it. They may not. Doesn't matter. They're nine. Who cares? You know, you try to keep your kid healthy. But here's what she's wearing. There's two different pictures. One is the original outfit, and it's a T-shirt. It says love, but it's the O is kind of like a Minnie Mouse shaped head because it has the bow on it. So it says love, and she's wearing leggings like all kids wear. So it's a long T-shirt, and then she's wearing leggings. Well, the educator said this is way, way too tight. Even though, listen, when you're a kid and you're struggling with your weight or not struggling, you're just a certain weight, whatever weight you are. Sometimes your clothes, or when you're adult, sometimes when you're heavy, your clothes are a little tight. That doesn't mean they're, you know, I think the rule for tight clothes is for a more provocative outfit. But of course, when you have zero tolerance, you don't care about that. You're not going to nitpick. You're going to enforce the rules no matter what. So, the school is being shamed for bullying after the girl's uncle went public, which was nice. In a Facebook post, Robbie Nettles, the girl's uncle, shared side-by-side photos of his niece in two outfits, both, as I mentioned, wearing a T-shirt and leggings in each one. She was immediately sent to in-school suspension because of her quote-unquote form-fitting clothes. Really? A nine-year-old in a Minnie Mouse T-shirt? That's long. It's not like a midriff. It's not tied up like a Hooter Girl shirt. It goes down over her butt. And she's wearing leggings that don't look overly tight. They look like leggings. She looks fine to me. She looks like a million other nine-year-olds that I've seen running around town. Well, he posted part of his post, quote, does this punishment seem appropriate to you? And that's my question to you. When do schools have to stop with the overall big brother mentality and start looking at people again and kids again as humans and going, all right, our rule is a sound rule. We don't want people coming to school dressed really provocatively. This girl is not doing that. So why embarrass a nine-year-old? Because we're too dumb to be able to parse out punishments based on a case-by-case basis. We have to do it. It's one size fits all and everybody loses.
But it's two different camps. It doesn't make sense. If it's provocative or revealing, that's one argument. But if it's just because you think it's too tight and doesn't look good, that's no merit for a
right.
suspension.
Mr. Blackwell is not your principal.
Right.
The fashion police from Us Magazine are not running the school board. You may not think she looks good. She may have loved that outfit.
Right.
And now you've crushed her. And just because her body does not fit into whatever framework you think a nine-year-old should look like, and it may not be the healthiest, but you know what? That's not your problem at some level.
Right.
Her parents have dressed her to the best they could. She looks okay. Again, it's not like the website, you've seen that one where the people of Walmart, and it's people who are wearing things that no way they should wear.
Right.
Those are grown-ups.
I know. But those are grown-ups, and they've made their own decision. This is a child who doesn't look anywhere near that level of tightness or craziness.
I have a similar story.
Oh.
When I was growing up, I went to a Catholic school, and I got sent home in fifth grade because I wore sandals without pantyhose.
Oh, well, listen.
And now nobody wears pantyhose with sandals.
Right, but listen. You're tempted. Why are you tempting the males with your bare feet? Why are you trying to get everybody to go to hell?
I still don't understand. I was just a little girl.
Little girly toes were obviously a distraction. You better encase them in nylon and make sure that they can't wiggle around.
I don't understand.
So what happened?
I had to go home. My mom had to come and pick me up. It was very
shameful.
They
bring you back?
Yeah, I came back to school with pantyhose. Yeah, I had to put on pantyhose and come back to school.
Wow. Really? And the nun, was that, I mean, it must have been in the rule book somewhere, right? That you have to wear socks
no,
or pantyhose?
No, there was no rule. There
no
wasn't.
Rules.
They were just flabbergasted.
You know who makes the rules? The nuns make the rules.
Yeah.
And if you're exposing anything from your toe all the way up to your knees, that's it. I mean, I know.
Yeah, but our uniforms were short skirts.
Well, sure. I know
our
what
legs
a,
were
listen,
clear.
I know what
we
a Catholic school uniform looks like.
We didn't have to wear pantyhose with our uniforms.
I went to Catholic
seriously,
school.
Seriously, what's the, oh, okay.
I know what the uniforms look like. And now every guy is going, yeah, I know what they look like too. we had to wear in our Catholic grade school, it was navy blue pants, a white shirt. We had a plaid, when you got to an older grade, it was a plaid long tie clip-on. Young kids, it was the plaid bow tie clip-on. And then you could wear a green, like, cardigan or a vest.
It had to be green. It couldn't be blue.
No, had to be green. That's blue, white, green. That was the color scheme. That was how they liked it. And then the girls had to wear the skirts, but they had to wear, I'm trying to remember, it was mostly socks, you know, like knee socks kind
of
thing.
Yeah, like knee highs.
Yeah, knee high socks. It wasn't
ankle
that,
socks. There, that you did wear socks,
yes.
But your legs were bare. My legs still were bare.
Right,
at
of course
every
they were.
Day in my uniform.
But not your nasty toes. Maybe you had crazy hammer toes or something. Maybe the nuns were freaked out by your feet. There are people who don't like seeing other people's feet. Maybe all the nuns at your school just were like, there was a group phobia about toes, bare toes.
I don't know. It was weird. I still look back at it. It was shameful and awful to me then, and now I just think it was weird.
I don't blame
it.
It is weird.
It's just weird.
No, it is weird. You're absolutely correct. And now if that were me, I would have never worn pantyhose again.
I don't ever wear pantyhose. I don't even have any pantyhose. I hate pantyhose.
Sure, of course you do. Why wouldn't you?
They're itchy and gross.
The nuns put the hammer to you.
That's right. They ruined it for me.
Of course they did. Anyway, the girl's mother brought her what she thought was a better option, so they changed. She changed into a different T-shirt, which actually seems to fit a little looser. And it's longer, and she's still wearing leggings, and they didn't like that one either. So, they sent her home. They deemed that one unacceptable. And this poor girl, again, it looks just fine. The reaction has been fast and furious, as you can imagine, because the internet is nothing if not discreet and calm and measured in their response to everything. Somebody said, it's so sad. There's nothing wrong with her outfits, which I agree 100%. The school, of course, is standing by its suspension, just like Laura's nuns. They're standing their ground. The dress code that bans too tight clothes. Brookhaven School District Superintendent told the newspaper there that school officials followed proper protocol. Well, then school officials need to have their heads examined. Meanwhile, on Facebook, people are calling the punishment heartbreaking. No 9-year-old should have to deal with this situation and made to be feel criticized about her body weight. So once again, educators, for very educated people, sometimes you ain't that smart. Think about it before you just go ahead and
we're going to make sure that we enforce these rules because, God forbid, a 9-year-old wears pants that are a little tight. That'll just get everybody all worked up. We can't have that in our school. We're going to keep everybody just wear caftans. That's what we'd like you to wear, big, billowy blouses. If you could dress like pirates, that would be fun, but not with all the jewelry because that, again, is that's weird. We don't like that, but just big. You know how Chef Paul Prudhomme used to dress just in a big sheet, basically a poncho? If you could wear just a poncho and a hat, that would be nice to school.
A burka.
Burka, sure, anything. Anything that covers everything and is very flowing. If you saw a production of Joseph in the Technicolor Dreamcoat. If you won't get yourself a Dreamcoat, we'd let you wear that because that's big and billowy. All right, shut up. People are just dumb. All right, it's time to check one final time. Let's head upstairs, shall we? The woman who is not wearing pantyhose never has, never will, unless a nun is in the traffic room, and I don't think that's going to happen. Laura Vaughn has a traffic trouble spot sponsored by the Illinois Department of Transportation. Sarah, I was wondering if you were going to unleash that on us.
Oh, won't you smile for me?
Yes. Brian Noonan in for Rokon and Anna DeVlantes. Hall & Oates. If you don't know the story of why Joey plays Sarah Smile every time he produces for me, you go back, search on WGNRadio.com, find the podcast, figure it out. It's a long, tawdry story of a 30-plus year grudge that I held against Hall & Oates that has been finally put to rest after my summer of fun. So Daryl Hall and John Oates now off my list, making room for two more new additions. Somewhere, somehow, two more people will be added to the list. You don't want to be on the list. Ask Hall & Oates. They begged me for years. Can we get off the list? I said, no. There's only one way to get off the list. And they finally are off the list. So thank you for bringing it makes me happy and yet puts me on edge when you play that song for us, Joey. Mark Harmon coming up after 7 o'clock. He's in for Justin Kaufman. The aforementioned Don Norton will be in doing news for him. It's a fun-packed night here on WGN as the Labor Day holiday continues. Do you have holiday plans after this, Joey? You going home doing something exciting?
I hear that my family brought me back whatever was barbecued.
Oh, that's nice.
So I'm still liked, I guess.
Very good.
I'll sneak maybe a hamburger in before the night's over.
There you go.
How about yourself?
My wife has made some potato salad, and I am going to grill some brats when I get
good
home.
Good deal.
A little Labor Day. I think we did it. What day did we did that on the 4th, too, where she was
very
like,
nice.
All right, I'll do this. Because she didn't want to forego any sort of Labor Day cookout. And I was like, all right, I got to eat when I get home.
Yeah.
Even though I don't know what kind of bacon's been in that. I don't know where that bacon came from. It was probably here with Dave Plyer at like 6 o'clock this
that
morning.
That sounds
I'm like,
about right.
Bacon, that sounds tasty. Had a few pieces of that. all right, if you were going to get plastic surgery to look like any sort of celebrity, what facial features would you want? I would want none. I think my visage is perfect just the way it is. Look at this moneymaker, Joey. Would you change a thing on it? No.
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not. Yours is fine as well, and Don's just as well. I wouldn't change any of your looks. Some people are more vain than us, though. They need to get plastic surgery. They want to look like somebody else. They want to nip here, a tuck there. I don't know what they want to do. But a prominent plastic surgeon was interviewed, Dr. Julian De Silva. He has been creating a list of most wanted facial features from 1,000 patients who had cosmetic procedures with his London practice. And here is what they decided. The number one facial feature that people who are getting cosmetic surgery want is the Kate Middleton nose. Yes, the Duchess of Cambridge's nose is supposed to be mathematically perfect. So, Joey, that's why you and I never noticed it, because it was mathematically perfect. It's delicate and feminine. Science confirms that Middleton's nose, with its 106-degree nasal tip rotation, deserves a place on the world's most perfect face. Wow.
106-degree nasal tip rotation?
That's
did you
right.
say that?
I did say that. I read it verbatim. Because, Don, if I'm going to contemplate a new nose and I'm thinking of making my nose a Duchess nose, I don't want 104-degree nasal tip rotation, 108-degree nasal tip rotation. Give me 106. That's perfect. And then Daddy Schnoz is perfect.
106. Got it.
The rest of the face, though, does not measure up to that perfect nose. The rest of the face, you'd go, man, I don't know. His nose is fantastic. But wow, what is going on with the rest of that? Thankfully, he draws all the attention into the center, because the outlying areas, they are horrifying.
You would not look good with Kate Middleton's nose. I just have to tell you.
No, I barely look passable with my nose. People want Keira Knightley's eyes. I don't know why. They don't say those are scientifically. Her eyelids. That's the thing.
Oh,
her eyelids. Yeah. Keira Knightley's eyelids. Look it up. I don't know.
Not even the eyes. Just the
eyelids. Just the eyelids. Jennifer Lopez's big archy eyebrows. Those are the other one. Penelope Cruz's lips. Because they are, according to this, the envy of women across the world. And when people are getting lip augmentation.
Guys like it too.
Sure, for a whole other reason. I have found, and maybe I'm seeing the women whose lip augmentation has not been successful. Those don't look good.
Mm.
They look all puffy and like they got stung by a jellyfish. They want Reese Witherspoon's skin, Angelina Jolie's cheeks, Miley Cyrus's forehead, Selena Gomez's chin, and Cher's jawline. That's what the people are looking for when they want a little bit of cosmetic surgery. All right, we're going to do this real fast. And then Mark Carman has decided to wander in. We didn't know if he was actually here or not, but he's here. We'll talk to him in a minute. Hang on. You're talking. I have headphones on. Mark Carman is here for Justin Kaufman tonight, downloading things I hear.
Yes, I'm going to
welcome.
What is that Roe says? Justin Kaufman's going to download himself. I plan on downloading myself tonight, along with Don Norton in the news, who is the most. I feel like when I work with Don Norton, Brian, that I am working with radio history legendary.
I agree. I said that myself when he came in, and he always looks the part. Don is a professional from way back.
I mean, he's wearing a tie.
I like it.
I'm barely wearing underwear.
It's a red, white, and blue tie in honor of Labor Day.
See? There it is. Look at that. The man is a genius. What do you got on? What are you downloading?
We got a lot going on tonight.
So sounds like you don't have no idea.
That too. There's a real movement going on now with Colin Kaepernick. So we're gonna start there.
Oh boy.
I know. I knew you'd love that. But the president has weighed in, and
sure, and other athletes are now kneeling down too.
So there's a discussion to be had here, and we're gonna do that to start, and then we're going to get a Dr. Bob and a Dr. Judith Wright. Do you fight in your marriage, Brian? You ever have any fights?
Oh, sure. It's all lovey-dovey. Well, yes, we fight all the time.
Well, fighting is good.
Of course it is. That's why I made it almost 25 years.
Right. You got to be able to brawl. So we're going to have a little...
Physically?
My wife can
take a punch. I don't know.
I don't think you need to get physical, per se. That would all be right. That's uncomfortable. But there is a...
I'm kidding. For those of you who are now sending angry emails, here we go.
Yes.
There'll be all sorts of comments. I'm kidding.
Yes, Brian.
My wife can't take a punch. What? Oh, see what I did? That was horrifying. I'm sorry. I'm still joking.
Do you still beat your wife?
Cannot answer that question. When did you stop beating your wife? Yeah. Same question.
Very awkward start, but very excited to do the show.
All right. Well, go do it. Have fun.
All right. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com. News at 7 o'clock, sponsored by Builder Supply Outlet. Here is Don Norton.